then intricate castles appear. Sing the beauty, the trees that surrounded me. It's down the pathway I went. Waterfalls and streams, and on to the hallways, heavenly ornament. I wanted to stay, soak in the beauty as music somewhere softly plays. Slowly it faded and I woke up. I want to return again. I'd like to know more of this lotus land. Over the rainbow, take me away, back down the pathway. I want to return again. Oh, please don't forget me. Come silhouette me and be my friend. I fell asleep and in my dreams I found a new down pathways, moonbeams, and intricate castles appear. Thing of beauty, trees that surround me, down the path. Falls and streams onto the hallways, heavenly ornament. Take me away, back down the pathway. I want to return. Oh, please don't forget me. Come silhouette me and be my friend. I'd like to know more of this lotus land.
That was a number by Opal Son, who's also known by the street name Vision Song Valerie. She's a Huffster and a SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, street singer in Santa Cruz. She does singing events every Tuesday night, I'm told, though I'm not often down there, on Pacific Avenue, as the crackdown on musicians and political activists and homeless people generally down there intensifies. Or So I'm told. I tend to focus on these abuses generally by the police and by those who want to drive away poor people. So I kind of, it's a constant diet I have, and I also, of course, feature it on my show so people can hear just what's happening. But it's often puts me in a position where I can't really judge the relative changes, and I take some of my perspective from other people as to what they see. And so feel free to be a part of this dialogue. What's going on downtown in Santa Cruz? How are the police behaving? How are the folks in the street behaving? It's actually about the broader issue of the city's response to basic human needs, like the right to sleep somewhere, not everywhere, but somewhere, is to try to drive away the people and drive away protesters and make it more and more difficult to use public spaces, since public spaces are the last refuge of civil liberties, the only refuge of civil liberties for those who have no home, and often for the community generally to engage in dialogue with the rest of itself. That's why the sidewalk is considered to be a public forum in the legal language of the courts. That is to say, it's, if you're going to shut down somebody from speaking on the sidewalk, you better have a fairly good reason for doing so, like, you know, they're, I don't know, inciting people to arson at the moment, or breaking windows with the volume of their voice, or screaming at 3 in the morning. There is a heightened threshold for going after people on the streets. And, of course, that's only true if people stand up for their rights and if courts enforce them and if other members of the community stand up for this as well. And that isn't happening yet in Santa Cruz because people are otherwise preoccupied, and the, frankly, the bigots are on the march in Santa Cruz, at least if you, well, it's not a good source to go from, but I saw the Friday Sentinel, and I wasn't too encouraged by what I saw on the front page below the fold, an article about how the merchants have moved from talking about behavioral problems and, oh, no, we're not anti-homeless, we just want to get rid of people who act like homeless people in public spaces, but they aren't. That doesn't mean we're really after homeless people. Like, they have to sit down, so we make it so that a bench can't be used for more than an hour. We make it so that 95% of the sidewalk is illegal to sit on. We make it so that these little penguin statues are set up that further eliminates seating space within 14 feet of each one of those statues, and then 14 feet of a building, 14 feet of a crosswalk, 14 feet of a directory sign, 14 feet of a phone booth, 14 feet of a sidewalk cafe, and so forth. And we also make it illegal to chat in the parking lots throughout the city of Santa Cruz, the public parking lots and the public parking garages. But, oh, no, it's not directed at homeless people. Anyway, that story is now moved on, and people have kind of bared their teeth, some of the people who are actually pushing these anti-homeless laws. And they are acknowledging it's the homeless people. They're driving away our business. They're creating a depression. The homeless people, the homeless panhandling, drug dealing gangs. And it all gets very much conflated as a sort of a hysterical smear campaign heightens. And I'll be talking a bit about that. This, again, in the face of what's really happening, is people are, just through their very presence, making clear the need for facilities that are not being made available, by which we don't mean gold-plated couch, you know, luxurious sofa-lined mansions, but campgrounds where people can legally sleep, where they have access to toilet and washing facilities and storage facilities, the basic human necessities that people need and that they will get one way or another if they don't have access to them. It's just ridiculous. And if you don't want to give them those facilities, well, then don't be surprised if they fall asleep where they can. Perhaps you were thinking I was going to say that they take those facilities. Well, the public land belongs to all of us, and provided, you know, you're not despoiling it, and sleeping on public land does not despoil it, then it seems to me you have a perfect right. In fact, for many, it's a need to use it. So, but you may think differently, or you may have some stories about this that you think are important to share. The phone number here is 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. This is an old struggle. It's been going on for decades in Santa Cruz and in other cities as well. In fact, you might say for millennia, between the rich and the poor. The rich feel they have the right to regulate everybody else's behavior, control the world for their own benefit. The poor insist on something for themselves and usually are content with far less than they have a right to or entitled to or need, or it would be wise for everybody to have some access to, or such is my view. This is a flashback that I was going to play earlier today, but I, unlike Thomas, who was the early bird this morning, I didn't wake up, but I'm awake now, and normally I play this during his show, these flashbacks. He's very nice in that regard and lets me slip in. But now I'm going to play it during my show. This is an interview with a guy called Charles Gray, way back in October 22nd, actually, of 1988, almost 20 years ago. Actually, 22 years ago, come to think of it, or 21 years ago, really, more or less, since it was back in October. Charles Gray was quite an activist. He was arrested several times with homeless demonstrators challenging the sleeping ban. That's the city's law that criminalizes homeless people, criminalizes everyone who sleeps outside after 11 o'clock at night on public property. But that, of course, means almost entirely homeless people. And that's what we find when we look at the tickets. They go to people with no address who are homeless. So this isn't really a law designed to regulate camping among the housed. It's a law designed to criminalize and exclude and punish and deter people without houses, also travelers. So you might say to some extent it's a cynical attempt to shove people into much more expensive motels and hotels, I know, to end the depression so the merchants can stop blaming the homeless, you see, and so they can get higher income, and so they can pay more taxes that can support the wonderful social services that provide shelter for 5%, in some cases 7 to 10% of the homeless people in Santa Cruz. Isn't that peachy? Anyway, Charles Gray was a guy who was quite an individual in his own right. He claimed, and I believed him, that he lived on his share of the Earth's income, which amounted to about $130 a year. He built everything himself. He survived on food that he scavenged or he traded for. He was also quite eloquent in how he spoke, and I think we're going to be listening now to an interview that he did with, it was either a City on a Hill Press reporter or some other individual who was interviewing him. This is Charles Gray. He moved later to Oregon, where he became an activist. I believe it was in Eugene with the Homeless Coalition there. I saw him again 6 or 7 years later. Haven't followed him since. Dorothy Granada, I believe, was his partner for quite a while. She's an activist who spent a lot of time in Central America. And he was quite a guy. And who knows, probably still is quite a guy. Anyway, let's hear this flashback interview, and maybe I'll even turn up my mic so you can hear me, too, as the show goes on.
First of all, I know basically about what the ordinance is and why people are opposing it, and just a little bit about it.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Why don't you tell me about your case, about your specific case, how the judge decided not to hear you, and what the circumstances were of your arrest.
Okay, I participated in one of the sleep-in protests at the town clock on the night of September 2nd, 3rd. And it was essentially a protest. We had banners, and we talked to people passing by, and we talked to some KZSC people. But we also had sleeping gear because, in our view, if you're willing to risk arrest, it somehow strengthens your voice when you're on a public issue, if you're willing to take that chance. So though I'm not actually homeless, I support the homeless in their demand for a removal of a camping ban, and so I participated. And so I was ticketed along with 6 other people that night, about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was lying down like the others were, under blankets or in a sleeping bag or something. And so I got a ticket, and then we got court dates just the last couple weeks. And I was supposed to have a trial this past week on Friday. Yesterday. Yeah. And however, Linda Edwards had a court date earlier, and so that case is being tried before Judge Attic. Mine was in a different courtroom with Judge Kelly, and so essentially what happened is that Judge Kelly figured he'd better see what how the other trial went before he gave me a trial. So simply he just delayed it, so I'm not sure whether I'll have a trial or whether if Linda Edwards, who is at the same action, precisely the same circumstances, if she is acquitted, why, my hunch is that probably the charges would be dropped, but I'm not sure. Let's see. Well, maybe that's enough on that.
Well, from what I understand, there's a part of the ordinance that says if it's being done as part of a protest, it's covered under free speech to be protesting. Now, how does that apply to your case? Is that going to be considered?
Well, no, actually, the ordinance itself doesn't allow for such a thing, doesn't talk about protests. It's simply the position of the defendants that this should be protected, this kind of a protest should be protected under the First Amendment of free speech, because it's a symbolic kind of speech. To do a protest where, in a sense, you're kind of doing theater. You're doing theater in a way, because nobody really sleeps at the clock. Nobody can sleep at the clock. It's too noisy. There's too much going on. And we know that the police are coming. And so, you know, it's a joke that if you sleep there, the purpose is to draw attention to the public to what's going on. So it's really essentially a purpose. And that's what the defendants are saying. Therefore, they are not guilty of violating the camping ban, because they're simply protesting. And nonetheless, that's kind of a fine legal point. And the police took the position that if we were appeared to be asleep, that, you know, we were violating the ban. Or if we had camping gear there. See, that's also part of the ordinance. So you can't have camping gear and being setting up camp. That's also illegal. And my own position is that the whole thing is an outrage. It's a fundamental violation of human rights to outlaw sleeping. How can you outlaw sleeping? It's not only a violation, but it's impractical. You can't do it. So all you're going to do is fill the jails with people. And you're harassing the most vulnerable people in the community. That's ridiculous. It's a war against the poor. That's what it amounts to.
The guy from SCAN, I was talking to him yesterday, and he told me that the city council has recommended to police officers that they only consider arrest under if there's been a complaint, and otherwise they leave people who are sleeping alone. Now, do you have the support of city council members that are incumbents, people who are currently on the city council in these cases? And what about the people that are coming, that are campaigning right now for city council positions? How are they? What stand are they taking on this?
Well, what you said about not ticketing people unless there's a complaint, I think has been a request of some of the homeless. But to my knowledge, the city council has not given such instructions to the police. And people are still being arrested whether or not there's a complaint. But I'm not sure. I think sometimes the police may not always arrest people. But as far as I know, there hasn't been any policy of that sort. And let's see, what was the second part of your question?
How do the present council members and the people running for council stand on that?
Well, it's...
And you're listening to, again, to October 22nd interview with Charles Gray back in 1988. It's interesting, many of us 4 months before presented a petition to the Task Force on Human Relations, which was headed by the now dead Jane Yokoyama, who became a council member of several years later. We were able to persuade the task force to recommend a very, very modest don't ticket homeless people in their vehicles unless there's a complaint. And Mayor Wormhout, I should say Mayor Laird and Vice Mayor Wormhout at that time, refused to even put it on the agenda, or at least it was never, it certainly wasn't voted. They actually considered the report, but that proposal was rejected in favor of giving out little cards, come to the homeless, to the River Street Shelter, which was the only, there was no homeless service center, there was no homeless community resource center. That was created by homeless protest and by essentially creating such a storm downtown that the merchants were demanding that there be some sort of magnet on the side of the area of the, out near Highway 1 that would remove homeless people from the downtown because they were protesting the criminalization of poor people at night. They wanted to be able to sleep at night, and because they weren't able to sleep at night due to the police and the merchants and city council and politicians pushing this drive out the homeless, they said, we'll come downtown and we'll stay downtown. And services were created that drew people away from the downtown and has, to some extent, been successful, not so much for sleeping. It was successful in the sense for a number of years, that and a number of de facto solutions, like the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, the so-called Back 40, where people were sort of quietly permitted to sleep without hassle for some time under Deputy Police Chief Mike Dunbaugh, when he was around in the early 90s. Anyway, this, but not so anymore, of course. Now they've been making it illegal to be in all kinds of different areas, and the people are literally driven to be downtown because it's one of the few legal places to be, although you can't be in most places downtown unless you have money or unless you're standing up. You can't sit down on 95% of the sidewalk. You can't sit on a bench for more than an hour. There's a whole series of a net or spider web or tripwire of anti-homeless ordinances that can be activated at any time by a merchant or by a police officer, and they don't even need an ordinance. They just tell you to move along and cook up something. That often happens as well, sometimes because you have new officers, sometimes because people just want to, you know, not get into any trouble. And if a police officer suggests they move along without any particular reason, well, they may do that. In this situation, though, the idea of ticketing on complaint, which seemed a pretty reasonable solution, and that wasn't a reasonable solution, it was a sort of a first step. I mean, you may have people who complain about anything and everything, and they don't want to have anybody, you know, within a 5-mile radius of their house or a 4-block radius of their house, even though there's no facilities, and they're safe and warm. They want other people to be far away from them, even though that's on the public space, and they have no business dictating what should happen in the public space if it's not injuring anyone. You have a situation where we have never been able to get city council to agree to ticket only on complaint. You'll hear Mayor Rotkin say, and he said it several times in interviews I've done with him on this show, oh, we only ticket on complaint and or if there's a political protest and or if it's a high traffic use area and maybe and or if it's a repeated defense. None of that, however, is in the law, and it is simply, essentially, a matter of police discretion. The idea that the police officer has the right to remove the rights of poor people at will, search them, interrogate them, seize their property, drive them into the night, affect their health and safety through these kinds of behaviors, and destroy their property, in the case of Ranger John Wallace, is really completely outrageous. And it was just as outrageous in 1988 to Charles Gray, who's talking about it to an interviewer, and who went to trial. The trial he's talking about was, by the way, I don't have the stats with me right now. I write about it extensively in what I call the Street Shit Sheet, which can be found in the public library in the reference section. The main branch is ask the librarian where the Street Shit Sheet is, and you'll be able to catch my take on all these ancient cases. But Linda Edwards did successfully challenge a portion of the sleeping ban, which had to do with this issue of permits, in the sense that Charles Gray pointed out you can't sleep at the town clock where everybody was doing their sleep out, but it was more of a public protest. And nonetheless, police came in and in a pretty heavy-handed way on a number of occasions, rousted people, arrested them, in some cases brutalized them, mostly just arrested them, ticketed them, cited them, drove them into the night, ended their First Amendment right to protest, and took them to court. Linda Edwards, through then-attorney Ray Gluck-Grunike, then called Ray Grunike, was able to show that there was an imperfect permitting process. What was the response of the city council when Linda Edwards won her case? Did they change the sleeping ban to make it more reasonable for people? No, they simply created a formal but difficult-to-use permit process that really, essentially, is almost never used by anybody because it involves putting down huge amounts of liability insurance and environmental impact statements and everything else. So it's a complete hoax. However, Linda Edwards and others were filling the courts with these cases. I was being arrested too at that time, and there was a massive presence at city council. People would show up by the dozens at council, demand to be heard, driving then Mayor John Laird to frustration because he couldn't proceed with the normal. These homeless people aren't there; they're not a problem in Santa Cruz. Business as usual, which he's been doing then and here and thereafter and since then, for the last 20 years, as he ascended higher office as assemblyman and so forth, without any kind of apologies. Ditto with Marty Wormhout, a recently died mayor and then supervisor. I don't have a lot of sympathy for these people, and I suppose I'm somewhat narrow in my criticism, I'm sure, in many other respects, both to their family and friends, and on other issues they did some good things. But their bald hypocrisy and cruelty on this issue is so intense, so persistent. Now, you might even say so common. So, you know, why should I criticize them if I don't criticize everybody else? I guess the answer is I do criticize. And it isn't really everybody else. It's politicians in power pandering to those who they fear might defeat them in the next election through being more bigoted than thou. It's really makes me grumble big time. Back to this Charles Gray interview from 1988.
To my knowledge, none of the people on the council, and only one of the candidates for the council, and that's Jane Immler, has come out in favor of dropping the camping ban.
In fact, Charles is a little mistaken there. There was quite a race in 1988, mainly because of all the homeless protests, I think. We'd literally gotten thousands of signatures on the petition for homeless rights, in spite of endless attempts by the police to seize our literature, ticket us for dropping a cigarette, or sitting on the brick planters. Those were the beautiful red brick planters that were up and down the mall that everybody sat on. But if a homeless person sat on them, they were open game for the police. This is in front of the old bookshop Santa Cruz where we had our table. There was another candidate running, Abdul Hassan, who was an African-American guy and a protester, kind of ran in coalition with Jane Immler, Calamity Jane, as we called her, who helped whose hunger fast helped establish the first cold and rainy night shelter in Santa Cruz 3 years before, and who was quite a famous figure in helping to establish the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and other things. They were running for city council on a platform of ending the sleeping ban. Ed Porter, at that time, said he favored campgrounds. And, of course, he also said he favored ending the sleeping ban he would put the sleeping ban on the agenda when he ran again successfully 12 years later in 2000, I believe. When he got on the city council, of course, he did nothing of the kind. And he helped pass more anti-homeless laws. Also running in that election and successful in that election was Don Lane, who, to his credit, made one attempt to change the sleeping ban. He made one attempt in January of 1989, about 3 months after this recording, by moving it, and he got no second, and that was the last thing he did around the sleeping ban law that I remember. Maybe Don, we used to call him Gone Lame because of that. Catherine Byers came on the council a month later because she was appointed to the seat that was left vacant by Mo Reich, who was elected in the same time as Don Lane in 1988. And she, although for about a decade before she became mayor and got a majority on the council, she was actually a spokesperson to some extent for homeless people. She would raise issues as a dissenter, particularly when Celia Scott got on the council as well in 1994. However, once Byers got a majority, in 1998. She turned against the basic issue of the sleeping ban repeal and helped to stop that effort. And we called her birdseed buyers or bullshit buyers. We had names for her that were not so much just sort of nasty epithets, but they were really a satirical description of what her positions had become. Anyway, here's more from 1988 and Charles Gray.
Rescinding the camping ban. She's the only one. Now, other folks have various positions, like Jane Yokoyama, for example, who's considered one of the progressive candidates, said she did not want to institutionalize camping. And I don't know whether that's still her position or not. And Lane favors, is sympathetic to the homeless, but to my knowledge, he still favors retaining the camping ban. Though he may favor establishing a city campground. I haven't followed the candidates that closely, but the others, as far as I know, are still favor keeping it.
Apparently, Porter is, because he's here, right? So the ultimate goal of this, of having this debate here, is to rescind the camping ban and to establish a city campground, or one or the other? What's the primary goal?
Well, I think the goal is just to raise the issue of the camping ban. Now, it's one tiny part of the homeless situation, and a lot of us would say that establishing a campground is one tiny part of the solution. I mean, you have to have affordable housing, really. That's an ultimate thing. But you can't wait around for affordable housing when there's an emergency. There are people sleeping on the street in the rain, you know? So as an emergency measure, you've got to have a place where people can legally camp. And so it's a pretty simple request, and it seems to me that the city council, if it looked at it as an emergency, could have a camp operating in 24 hours. They call in a Red Cross. They act like it was an earthquake, you know? They call in a Red Cross. They've got all the tents. They've got all the bedding. They've got everything. They've got portable potties and the whole schmear. All they need is a place, and there are lots of places, you know? If they look at it as an emergency, then they could take action that they can't otherwise take. And that's what it is. If you're sleeping on the street in the rain, that's an emergency. Now, if you want to sleep on the street in the rain, if you're voluntarily homeless, I mean, if you don't like to be under shelter, that's no crime. That's no crime. But there are a lot of people who are involuntarily homeless. And when they have to sleep on the street, that's a community crime. That's a crime of the community. And it's an emergency.
Are any of the goals to develop more shelters, more homeless shelters, something like that, or is that a possibility in Santa Cruz now with the trouble they had setting up the last one with the neighborhood, finding the neighborhood to build it in and everything?
Well, the city is expanding the present shelter, and some of the additional beds may even be ready this winter. And as far as I know, that's the end of their plans, and that will only be in about an additional, I think, 8 or 10 beds or something. But I'm not dead sure exactly how many, but it still will be inadequate in terms of the number of people. And homelessness is growing. I mean, every year there are more homeless in the United States. So it's really totally inadequate as a shelter.
So what is the fine that people are looking at who are arrested under this ban?
Well, I think the fines have been going from $50 to $125. And I think it has varied. And however, if you get two citations within 48 hours, it's a misdemeanor, which can be 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine.
And just to update that, because he's talking in 1988, due to pressure from homeless activists and community organizations that were helped to get online on this issue by homeless activists, and I don't just mean me, but a number of other people, Becky Johnson, Dave Silva, Paul Brindell, even, you know, people who were active in raising the issue of how, as Charles Gray had put it, how cruel, short-sighted, unconstitutional, he doesn't talk about that much, but maybe he will, an ordinance against sleeping is. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's medieval. So the fine now is in the, we were able to reduce the fine from a fine for an infraction can be anywhere up to $1,000, but with court costs back in 1988, usually it came to around $162 if you either paid the bail, which means paid the ticket without going to court, or showed up in court and if you were found guilty and then paid the standard fine, $160, $162 is my recollection. That was reduced to about a $54 fine, although it's $20 on the books, but with additional court assessments, it was $54 in 1999 with the help of those other activists, as I mentioned. That was when Catherine Byers, still on the council, now re-elected to the council now, the mayor then, was willing to, she abandoned her principal position of opposing the sleeping ban, instead saying there's just no place for them. Instead went for a reduction of the fine and also made it an infraction that you had to allow community service on and no less than 8 hours of, or no more than 8 hours of community service, which was ignored by the city attorney until we pushed it, and also ignored by the courts even as much as 5 or 6 years later. We had to press the case of a woman living in her vehicle, Sharon Pate, who's given I don't know, twice as many hours of community service for the crime of sleeping in her vehicle in the Total Fitness lot, where she was a member of Total Fitness, but the officers decided to ticket her. Could have been on instructions from, I don't know, the owners of the lot, who knows, based on something about we don't allow people to sleep in our lot, who knows. But again, the idea of... there was a reduction in 1999, so the fines had dropped to $54. They're now up to, as of a year ago, they were about $97, $98, something like that, because again of increasing court costs. And there is still a provision that if you camp twice within 24 hours, and that means not sleep, but actually have set up camping equipment. Or a campsite with the intention of remaining overnight, then you can be charged with something punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine, and or a $1,000 fine as a maximum. And you might say, well, that doesn't, you know, that's not sleeping, that's different. But police use that when they find somebody sleeping, I don't know, on their bedroll. Oh, this is a campsite, they'll say, you know. And even though all the person who is there has to do is say, I have no intention of remaining overnight, or just remain silent, the police have to prove that they intend to remain overnight. With the sleeping ban section, you don't have to, the police don't have to prove you intend to remain overnight. They just have to prove you're asleep at the time they find you. But with the camping ban misdemeanor section, they have to prove that, A, you intend to remain overnight, and then they have to come back and give you a second ticket within 24 hours, and that could make it a misdemeanor. Now, it's also true that the two homeless musicians that have been put under a preliminary injunction, that are facing a permanent injunction, that's Anna Richardson and Miguel De Leon, face immediate misdemeanor charges if they fall asleep anywhere in the downtown area, period. And that's interesting. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Uncle Robert here.
Hi, I have a question for Robert.
Okay, what's your name, caller?
I want to go anonymous.
Okay, anonymous, go ahead.
Well, my question is, so I helped volunteer at the homeless shelter in the last 6 months. I'm not going to say when because I don't want anyone to identify me. But okay. I was really confused by when we were serving food, why the staff gets to eat the food. Like, who pays for that food?
You actually are closer to that, and probably in a better position because you have contacts there to get answers to those questions. But I have heard, and this is sort of secondhand, that some of the food is donated by Trader Joe's.
Okay.
And other large places, so it doesn't cost anything. There was a claim by the former Homeless Service Center Director, Doug Loisel, whom you probably worked under.
I met the lady who was a director. She
Letitia Schwartz.
And introduced herself, and I only volunteered there twice in the last 6 months. I'm not doing it again.
I see.
But I was very confused because she came. I didn't know who she was, and she came in the kitchen, and you know, I don't know. I was just confused that the staff was eating the food because I know. I don't know. I don't understand. If there's leftovers, it should be go back out into the street, not to the staff who is getting paid.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It is true that, I mean, I got a couple thoughts on that. I think most of the, if not all the staff is homeless, not all of them, but some of them are homeless, so that's one consideration. But it has often been charged that people who are in the staff at the homeless service center, there's a certain amount of corruption that goes on there. The first, when clothing donations happen, they get the pick of the clothing, not because of any established procedures, but just because they happen to have access to it. I did hear also, and I played on free radio this show on Thursday when we had our evening show, an interview with a woman who substantiated a story by someone else, although I don't know if anybody was actually a witness to this, but they had heard about it. It was the rumor. Apparently people had seen it. A guy was arrested for demanding seconds, trying to get...
I actually heard that show when you were talking about that, and I was surprised because... And I was only there for 2 days, but we had a lot of leftovers.
Right.
And that, and I did the lunch shift. So that, and I think the lunch shift is closed to people out who aren't residents of the actual family shelter.
Well, it's also true, of course, that they're now charging 50 cents a meal, which isn't much to pay for a full
meal.
Really?
When did they start that?
They started it in the summer under Doug Loiselle. Then when they got a grant, they stopped it for a few months, and I believe it was resumed and has continued under the new director, Letitia Schwartz, or the new temporary director.
So that's, I met her, and she also came in to get a meal, and I'm like, I mean, I could, I don't know. I've been listening to your show for like 5 years.
Wow.
And so when I went in there, with, I tried to go with an open mind and not allow your words to pollute me.
I would hope not, man.
So I went in totally open-minded, and I'm like, ooh, I'm going to uncover, you know, nothing, because there's nothing here to uncover. And, I mean, the only thing that I really saw going in there was, you know, that the staff was eating, and I could, I think that the distinction was there are two different levels of staff. You could tell that there are staff that are doing, like, a job retraining program and are eating, and then there's the staff that, you know, they're like supervisors. You can see people's body, you know, language change when the supervisor people walk in.
Uh-huh.
It's a different, it's, you know, not the same, you know, like the different way that they greet each other. You know, there's a level of power there.
Right, right. So,
I mean, my main thing is I would like to know who pays for that food. If it's taxpayers or if it's donations, the people that are donating the money, do they want staff that, you know, how much is Lisa making? 50, 90K? Do they want her to also be eating that food? Or do they want it to be redistributed out to the other homeless people?
Right. Well, I think you and I might want it to be redistributed. Because the question might also be, you know, what percentage of the food actually does go to the staff? It's probably a very small percentage. But my concern would be the homeless people who want to have more food are, if the story that we both heard on the air is correct, and I don't know, maybe it isn't, maybe it's an exaggeration, but...
I think it's determined on the volunteer. So we stayed and actually hung out with people, and there were some of the homeless families, and the children in particular mentioned that there were some volunteers that were very strict and mean. Some of the older people, I don't want to be ageist, but were very strict about what portions you got, what you were allowed. A couple different little kids mentioned that to us.
Well,
and I thought it was interesting because I was like, here's second, here's third. I don't know. Maybe I didn't do it right.
Uh-oh, just giving away food.
I know.
Boy,
and the only other thing I found was there was a moldy dish in there.
A moldy
and
dish?
And it was in the, like, serving area, not the kitchen, but it was in the serving, you know, area at the family shelter. And I packed it away, sent it off.
Good for you.
My second day there, I was like, I couldn't believe it was still there. I hope I'm not revealing who I am, because I did actually send an email.
Now
to
we
saying,
know exactly who you are. We're going to be sending the FBI.
I did send an email saying, you know, that moldy dish was in there for 2 days, and it looked like it had been there. I mean, the mold was, like, hardened, so.
Well, let's further pin down who you are. What month did you work in?
Oh, I'm not going to say.
Okay.
You know,
I worked at UCSD,
and I volunteer all over Santa Cruz, and in general, I enjoy my volunteer work.
Well, come volunteer for Huff. We'll give you some things to do.
You know, you're just too radical. You know, you have a bad reputation.
Listen, you know, you know what they say: good girls go to heaven, but bad girls go everywhere. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I believe in Huff. I'm a silent advocator of Huff.
Well, that's good. And, you know, remember, you can do work off to the side. If you want to give us a call and say do some computer work, we don't have to announce your name to everybody, you know. So
okay.
This goes for anybody else listening. 423-HUFF is a number to call. It's an off-air number in case you have a question or you have some information like this caller here who is kind of presenting some concerns. You know, if you're only there for 2 days, let's be fair, it's not, you know, it may have been a fluke what you saw, or it may have been, you know, a legitimate slice of what goes on there. I'm more concerned the fact that they would call the cops on some guy who asks for seconds, and that they would not, you know, that leftover food would be thrown away or given to the staff rather than given to the homeless people who are directly there to want it. There may be some difficulty in distributing it, let's say, on the streets, although that's not impossible to do. I mean, they could make connections with Food Not Bombs and so forth, which is an organization, as you probably know by listening to my show, that, you know, at least they serve on Wednesdays and I think on a second day. I'm not sure what they are.
Well, I would be really interested in you finding the person that happened to, because I'm just only having been there 2 days. I'm really curious as to how that went down and what staff members were there. I would like to know more information about it because I have a hard time.
Your assignment is to go out to the Dennis Adams meal today. You know Dennis Adams? If you've listened,
is that the guy at the park or the guy at the clock tower?
Dennis Adams was the guy at the clock tower, but he moved out to the Homeless Service Center on Sundays under pressure from the merchants. He has a meal every Sunday. I think it's at 1 o'clock out at the Homeless Service Center that's a little different than the meals that are normally at the Homeless Service Center. It's kind of a bigger meal. He also has a religious deal where, you know, he does the Jesus thing.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of homeless people gather at that meal, or they did when it was at the town clock. Maybe he has less people. I have not been able to get much information or any information out of him in the last few months. Maybe he thinks I'm too radical, too. Never can tell. But, you know, that's something you might want to check into. If you're looking for more information on this subject, you might be able to do it there. And it's a meal open to everyone. It's interesting that these homeless service center meals during the day are apparently rather, they were being, I heard that they were strictly judged. You weren't allowed to, you had to pay 50 cents. And if you were from some other program, like, you know, you were with Pioneer House would be one, but I don't know if you know Pioneer House is still open, but let's say the Rebelly Family Shelter or the River Street Shelter, you know, or Paige Smith or even Paul Lee, there was a sort of a different, you had a different status. There's a whole bureaucratic set of rules and procedures that seem to be loosening up under Doug Loiselle, which may or may not continue to be loosening up under Letitia Schwartz. I don't know. Anyway,
I think it'll be interesting to watch her. I don't know. You know, I don't want to judge a book by its cover.
For sure, and I expect you to, you know, read that book more thoroughly and continue to phone in your regular anonymous reports.
All right, thank you, Robert. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks for calling in as well. I appreciate that. If you want to call in, you can. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. We were listening to a flashback. Charles Gray, activist arrested with Linda Edwards and literally dozens of other people in the sleeping ban protests of the fall of 1988, when we were attempting to rescind the sleeping ban, as we still are, many of us, trying to do. Let's hear the rest of this interview.
So, you know, that's much more severe. And so far, the court cases have been on what they call infractions, which are just one arrest. And however, I think some people have gotten citations 2 in a row, and I think there have been some arrests for trespassing also. And I don't know how those are going to be processed.
Well, thanks.
Really
appreciate it.
At least, last time I glanced. Okay. And because of a change in the makeup of the panel, the suggested format that we settled on, just like Mr.
And actually, this is the the beginning of a formal debate on the camping ban that was held in 1988 at the little cafe that is now across from the Metro bus station on Front Street. Now, I'm not quite sure what it's called now, but it had a different name back then. And we actually had, I think, two or three people on each side. I think I've actually played this debate before. If not, I will be playing it again because I think it's interesting. Even though we're talking about a sleeping ban law that has changed in some superficial aspects, the same basic law is still in force. The same basic police harassment practice is still being followed. The same policy of driving them out of town, drive them on into the bushes, drive them elsewhere, is still being followed. And the same kind of protective cover you'll hear from the mayor or from others. We have the best social services of any town our size. No town in America lets people sleep on their streets. It's really a national problem. These nostrums that evade the basic issue that Santa Cruz authorities are every night and every day destroying and denying civil liberties for poor and homeless people, and even life-surviving behavior, you know, even survival behavior is being criminalized and is being punished and is being deterred. It's kind of low-intensity warfare. So let's take a musical break, and I'll be back with... I'm not sure if I'm going to discuss the new Sacramento lawsuit against the sleeping ban. There has been a lawsuit in Sacramento under attorney Mark Maron for some years now, and indeed some indication that the city of Sacramento is settling. But apparently the city has been, as you might say it, dicking around too much. And Mark Maron, who's a very successful attorney, has filed another lawsuit, which we're going to read about, or I'm going to read it to you. And by the way, there is a Huff email list. In case you want to be on the Huff email list and get this stuff before it even hits the airwaves, because and some of it won't ever hit the airwaves because I never have time to talk about enough of this stuff, you can get on the email list by sending me an email at rnorse, R-N-O-R-S-E, Norse, 3, number 3, at hotmail.com, rnorse3 at hotmail.com, and I will put you on the Huff email list, and you'll be able to read to your heart's content. Let's hear a little
And so what will I see today? Will I see myself in another way? For if only I'd open my eyes, or will I blindly not notice I'm alive? Not feeling the light of my senses, have I put up too many defenses? I must let go of the laziness and tears that have come from my doubts and my fears, and run away from them to see the sun come up and the birds fly over the water. And feel the joy of today, and find meaning in one day. And see as I traverse, I am part of a pattern of the universe. One big hole, a continuum in the light unites us all, a spectrum energy in that man. And so, if I let go of the struggles and strife of competing and conflict in one little how I relate, I will enter a mindset as a receptor and transmitter of all of the energy all about me. A continuum, and the light unites us all.
Was another one by Opal Sun. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Name of the show is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. And for those who don't catch that because I slur over the words, that's Bath Robespierre's Broadsides. Robespierre, of course, was a French revolutionary figure, most famous by right-wing critics who attacked him for the Reign of Terror. It wasn't just right-wing critics. Some critics on the left had their heads chopped off, didn't like him much either. But his expressed concern was to spread rights to the broader French population, but fortunately centralized power, and that can often be a deadly kind of remedy that doesn't work. So let's see. I think we may have a caller on Free Radio, or we may have, this may be another call. Let's see what's going on here. Hi, is this a call for Free Radio?
No.
Oh, well, stay on the line and I'll catch you. Don't go away. I think that sounds more like a caller that wants to talk to me rather than to Free Radio. Of course, I'm here at Free Radio, so what else can this caller do? Let me turn now to some more street interviews, and then I'm going to go back to what I mentioned earlier, actions in Boulder, Colorado, Sacramento, and Gainesville, Florida. And those are significant actions that have impacted civil rights for poor people. And we'll see what's cooking with that. Plus, of course, Santa Cruz. The Santa Cruz Sentinel on Friday had the rather nauseating story about how homeless people are to blame, according to merchants and downtown residents, for the economic woes of Pacific Avenue. This is an old, tired, false tale, but we'll be reexamining it again in a few minutes. Well, let's see what we have here, though. We should be getting a street interview or two coming up in just a moment. So
here on a sometimes sunny, sometimes overcast day with many criminals walking their dogs on the mall, very questionable, and not being very friendly to those commenting on that fact. It's around 1:30 at Pacific and Soquel, and I'm talking with
Carbugga Chris.
Chris, you're here since 9 o'clock with only $3 to your name.
That is correct, sir. It is the usual February doldrums. Apparently, the more we need, the more their hearts close up.
60 cents, 70 cents an hour. That's pretty cheap.
Cheap.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap to hold down the sidewalk.
So, we're going to bring your friends, a local host. Perhaps he will kick down.
Nah, it's doubtful. They're not allowed to when they're on duty. They're not allowed to put money in the hat when they're on duty.
That sounds like a violation of something.
Yeah, but he comes back after, though. He's donated regularly.
Well, good for him.
He comes back after the uniform comes off, and then he kicks. So in fact, all three of them do. To be honest with you, all three of them have given money out when they were off duty. So I can't really kick on their generosity.
Simply their behavior while on duty.
Correct. Which is not their fault, because it's a job that should go, not necessarily them. You know what I mean?
I
mean,
I suppose.
Some of them do the job rather reluctantly, like Thomas and whatnot, to the barest minimum necessary to get by. Thomas is one of them, so.
So, you say you've been here noticing a renewed enforcement activity by the SCPD's much-beloved Officer Wilson?
Yeah, at least today he went through and it was a no.
Officer Wilson is a woman.
Oh, well, then it's Winston then.
Okay.
And, He went through not even 10 minutes ago, and I just noticed a difference because there were no exceptions. You know, the last weeks and weeks, since really the whole holidays, it's been a lot of exceptions. You know what I mean? A lot of them giving a lot of warnings and not trying to really bust jobs. And then today was just starkly different, only because he went through and he couldn't pass like 20 feet without getting somebody, because everybody was relaxed. Everybody relaxes into that mode of thinking, oh well, it's
criminally sitting down on the sidewalk.
Yeah, well, one guy got it for the bench, over an hour on the bench. I haven't seen that one go out in a while, man. So that's unusual, you know what I mean, to see a bench hour thing. I haven't seen one of those since I've been back in town. I only had your word.
Check the chalk mark on the guy's shoe. I mean, how did he know he was there for more than an hour?
He had come through earlier in his car and noticed the guy.
But, of course, that doesn't mean that the guy didn't get up, leave the bench, and then come back and sit down. So I don't think that ticket would meet the standard. I mean, it's... I have to examine the actual wording of that ordinance, but it sounds really hard to show. It's easier to show the display device because it's your display device. But to see the bench, I'm going to look at the actual wording of the ordinance for that sitting on a bench. How do you show that they've actually been sitting there for... No person shall sit down or otherwise occupy a public bench or use a public bench to store property for more than a total of 1 hour during any given 12-hour period. Yeah, I think you have to show that they have been sitting on the bench for an hour. And unless the police officer was watching that person continuously or has testimony to that effect, I don't think it's sufficient to say that they saw them at 1 o'clock and then saw them again at 2 o'clock. But... the judges may be so police besotted that they don't care what the actual wording of the law says. They just want to help the officer clean up the downtown.
And And the guy's a known fellow around here. Like, you know, he's a
known sitter.
He's an easily observable street person. Let's just put it that way. Bright, you know, bright.
Not the kind of person you really want to have around.
Well, no, you try to stay invisible, actually.
What's that?
Well, you know, yeah, actually, you're right. You try to stay invisible if you can.
Whoa, horses. It's only robbers. It's okay.
Here goes that dream catcher guy. So, any other citations other than this unfortunate an hour and 1 minute on the bed?
Yeah, he didn't make it. I mean, he wrote three tickets right here in the corner. I mean, he wrote two in front of New Leaf and then one on the bench right there. So, and I assume he walked the entire street, both sides. I assume that that continued up and down with equal results. I mean, within half a block, he wrote three tickets. So,
but he didn't ticket you, eh?
No. They've decided they'd rather leave me alone. I think they figured out that I know you, and they just figured it's not worth the shit. To be honest with you, it's kind of a blanket immunity unless I, like, start pissing in a planter or something like that. So.
Well, I don't think you actually are doing anything illegal, even though you're seated.
No, that's never stopped him before, though, Robert. When does that ever stop him, man? You know what I mean? They're going to cite me for sitting on a milk crate. I've been cited for fucking...
Milk crates are illegal to possess. They're felonious to possess in California.
Yeah, but that's, who's to say sitting on it is possession? I found it next to the garbage can and I sat on it. That's not possession. And who's to say I wasn't returning it as a dutiful citizen returning stolen property to Greenboro Farms or where the fuck it come from? I'm going to hitchhike up there and return it to him. I found it on the street.
All right. Well, that's enough of that.
Yeah.
So to speak. So,
well, come on down and help out because it's a hot winter and all I need is candles and propane, man. It's fucking easy shit, man.
Are you still going to be selling street spirits? Or have you abandoned your news quest?
No, I haven't. I just sold out, man. That's all. I did my job too well and ran out. Hi, Donna.
I hope so. There goes Donna Dice, who... What did she win?
Money from the cops for busting her arm up like that. Little old woman, by the way, that we're talking about. I mean,
where did you hear this?
I mean, I don't know if she liked being termed that way. But
when did you hear this?
She told me this week when I got in, she bought me lunch as a celebratory gesture of her winnings.
Good for her.
So she got some fucking money, but no apology, man. So
she didn't have much to say to me, and she didn't consult much with us. So we put in a lot of energy trying to help her out.
She refused an interview, actually. I tried to get an interview about it. She didn't want to go on the record about any of it. So
really depressing because that's the kind of stuff that really needs to be trumpeted and talked about.
Sure, anytime we win. I mean, the rare victory needs to be at least brought up, sure. They score enough points on us, man. You know what I mean? So
Donna, why have you deserted us?
What the fuck is this thing about?
And actually, Donna Dice, who was... assaulted by Sergeant Christian Lamas, by her report and that of four or five other witnesses. It's not clear whether she was dragged through the courts and finally pled guilty to one count of littering for having dropped the coffee cup as Sergeant Lamas slammed her around as she attempted to get into her vehicle, rammed her down to the ground, broke her arm, and handcuffed her arm. And held her there for 15 minutes to half an hour, according to the reports, again, of Donna and other witnesses. She was originally charged with resisting arrest and marijuana and whatever they could find in the area, but they eventually settled for the only one charge, an infraction littering charge, which had nothing to do, of course, with anything that was happening, but was their way of trying to stop her from a lawsuit. But since the lawsuit wasn't about false arrest, but was about excessive force, the lawsuit apparently has gone forward, though Donna has not been back in touch with us in any significant way to talk about this issue, and I don't know what's really going on with that case. If anybody does, if Donna's listening and she feels like calling in, that would be great. We really need to know if there have been some victories here. If there haven't, we need to know that, too. Call-in number here is 427-3772. 427-FRSC for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Give me a call.
Fucking Super Cereal Bowls or something. What the fuck is going on? Is it some sort of sports thing or something?
I don't understand what you mean.
I don't know. It's some sort of football holiday or something.
Football has always been a mystery to me, but I thank you for giving me this interview.
You're
and
welcome.
Here's the sun for you for a few minutes.
Thank you.
And passing the Vita and Rosie McCanns, we have two bicyclists with American flags and banners, Alaska tour, and they're off for a 2,200-mile tour, 8.5 months on the road, and pausing on one of Santa Cruz's famous one-hour-only benches. But That's a story another man will have to tell. Or a woman.
So, hopefully we have a working mic. It looks like we do. Or a second working mic. I'm going to pause now from the street interviews, which you're listening to on Free Radio 101.1 FM, to go to a story from Boulder, Colorado. And this is a kind of an update. I don't know if I actually talked about it on the air, but I did send out an email on the Huff email list about Boulder's considering some changes in its sleeping ban law. And I think I may have referred to this before. Let me see if I actually have any discussion of it that I can see. Doesn't look like there's a lot of it here. But this article does contain some of the information, so I'll read some of this for you folks out there, and you can draw your own conclusions or take heart or be discouraged, as the case may be. Council says yes to Boulder Homeless, reads the article, meaning yes, they're working on it, and yes, you can still get a ticket for camping. This is by Rob Smoke, story February 8, 2010, on his website, which is boulderexpress.org. This is in Colorado, several states over. More than 1,600 illegal camping tickets have been given out over the past 4 years, mostly for sleeping in public spaces that provide shelter. Shelter is in quotes. Therein lies the rub. The ordinance states that a person must be using shelter of some sort to merit a ticket, and police have cited shelters that include a car, okay, a tree, huh, or a blanket. Oh, really? And all these exclamations aren't mine. They're actually in the writing of Rob Smoke. If it was raining and you were sitting on a park bench with an umbrella, you would technically be cited for illegal camping, since the umbrella would be your shelter. The Boulder City Council considered a moratorium on issuance of such camping tickets at their February 2nd meeting. It was the second time homeless advocates, including many homeless folks themselves, have appeared before the council recently to plead their case. Terry Sternberg, 57, a female homeless advocate, homeless herself, after having once had a home in Boulder, put it this way: what harm would a moratorium do? Make homeless people more visible? Before the council meeting, I met with her at the Carriage House facility where she works helping other homeless people on a daily basis. We talk about the ACLU victories, that's American Civil Liberties Union, for the homeless in California, the fact that our current law in Boulder is if we're sleeping under shelter, and those victories that they're referring to probably have to do with the Jones settlement in Los Angeles throwing out the L.A. sleeping, sitting, and lying on the sidewalks ban, the San Diego Spencer settlement, again, throwing out all enforcement of sleeping ban laws at night in San Diego, the Fresno settlement requiring, under the Kincaid decision, authorities to hold homeless property that they've seized for 60 to 90 days, I believe, instead of throwing it away within 3 days, as they do under Chief Ranger Wallace of Santa Cruz's enlightened policies. Then there's the Laguna Beach ACLU victory, where the Laguna Beach City Council essentially agreed to allow camping on the beach or sleeping on the beach when faced with an ACLU lawsuit. And there are currently pending lawsuits in Sacramento, Santa Barbara, and I believe Santa Monica around this issue. And there's rumblings of one. There's always rumblings of one in Santa Cruz, so it let it rumble on until we get some distinct, discernible clarity there. We talked, that is to say, the writer talked with Terry Sternberg about the ACLU victories for the homeless in California, the fact that our current law in Boulder is for sleeping under, quote, shelter, and how, in its essence, it criminalizes poor people for needing sleep over the years, and recently, in the case of a young man named David Bennis, a violator, has refused a plea bargain and demanded a jury trial. That case goes to trial Thursday, February 11th. So I've actually maybe in the paper. I'll have to check that one during the next musical break. In Santa Cruz, you don't get a jury trial for a sleeping ban case. You only get a trial before a judge or a commissioner like Basket, whom I call Basket case, or
Ariadne Simons, who I have not yet found the appropriate moniker for, but they're both very bad. Although, if you get a letter from the Homeless Services Center that says the shelters were full, you can often get Basket to agree to dismiss the case, usually, in fact. But again, this is after you've been rousted, interrogated, searched, directed to move, and gone to court at least twice. Although it's quite possible that you can get your ticket dismissed on arraignment now in Basket's court if you show up with a letter from the Homeless Services Center. The idea that you have to troop all over town to prove what everyone knows, that there are no there's no shelter space for the overwhelming majority of people in Santa Cruz, is a cruel and sort of cynical fiction that the city uses to justify unjustifiable policies in Santa Cruz. How about using enforcement money, writes this Boulder, Colorado writer. Terry asks, reasonably, what if we took all the money from the police time, the prosecuting attorneys, the legal aid attorney, the arrest costs if people don't show up for their court appearances, and the $70 a night it costs to keep someone in jail, I think it's significantly more than that in Santa Cruz, and put it towards just providing more assistance, such as more indoor shelter? Wouldn't that say a lot about this city, and wouldn't it be smarter? These are the same arguments you hear over the years. She may have a point. In fact, it was a point made effectively by numerous speakers at the February 2nd council meeting. One of them noted that historic figures like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, Indian slayers both, would be criminals under Boulder's law. The words of poet-novelist Anatole France were cited. While it may be equally illegal for the wealthy and the poor to steal bread or sleep under a bridge, a poor person would be the only one to get busted for it. Council members juggled their feelings of compassion, mention of which billowed in all directions against the will of at least some constituents who would prefer that Boulder do what Colorado Springs reportedly does, give homeless people a bus ticket to the out-of-town destination of their choice. Municipal Court Judge Linda Cook testified about the role of her court in treating the homeless with compassion. She noted that of the 1,600-plus tickets written in the past 4 years, almost all were paid for with community service. Of course, in Santa Cruz, you pay when you get community service. It's anywhere from $30 and up, even if you haven't got money. There's no provision, according to the community service workers, for suspending that fine. You can pay it off in installments, but there's no provision for poverty. This is an ongoing business that Community Options has. That's the sole monopoly provider of community service for court-ordered community service in Santa Cruz. Homeless advocate David Ward commented that rather than having homeless people do community service, perhaps community members could do service helping the homeless get back on their feet. Ward's organization, Nice World, assists homeless people by offering them temporary employment and by doing eviction rescues, helping them place their belongings in storage. That's, you know, when they come to take over your house or your landlord failed to pay his rent, his mortgage to the bank, and by God, suddenly you're out on the streets. I haven't gotten many reports how much that is happening in Santa Cruz, but it's happening elsewhere, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's happening here as well. People have reports on that. Please call in 423-4833 or any other information around the kinds of topics I'm talking about here. Economy has bred homelessness, according to this article. Several people challenged the stereotypical notion that homelessness results from wrongdoing or bad living, noting that many of the homeless are primarily victims of the crashed economy. Many caution that the presence of the homeless among us should be a wake-up call to officials. Unless they address the issue now, it may well just get worse. Well, I mean, you know, we've got some really reasonable expenditures. How many? $14 billion a month on the foreign wars of occupation and aggression in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and, of course, the upcoming exciting war in Iran, spearheaded by our great democratic leader, Barack Obama, the guy that, you know, that you voted for at the last election, that guy that you haven't said anything about, as you made no significant protest against while you were ranting and raving about Bush. But Obama, of course, can do no wrong. But he's just inherited it. See, he's just inherited it. I have to throw that in. I'm sorry. It really ticks me off, and hopefully it'll continue to tick me off. But getting back to Colorado story, not to stray too far afield, Ken Wilson, better known for his championing of economic vitality assistance to business, pitched in by pledging to coordinate an effort to get other Boulder City municipalities involved in finding solutions. Essentially, Boulder is the only city in the county hosting a homeless shelter. Although advocates agreed that the camping tickets criminalized poverty, city staff and council were not buying this analysis. Police Chief Mark Beckner emphasized the discretionary nature of the ticket and the fact that officers often use the threat of a camping ticket to compassionately persuade violators to seek shelter. This is, of course, the big mythology that there actually is shelter to seek. Some of the homeless people said they hadn't found the police all that compassionate. Demand exceeds supply, and this, of course, is what I was saying. So here we are in the middle of winter. Demand here has vastly outstripped capacity. There are an estimated 560 people homeless in Boulder and only 160 beds at the Boulder Shelter for the Homeless. The shelter on North Broadway has a waiting list, and BOHO's overflow facilities in Boulder only open if it's below freezing with precipitation or below 25 degrees without precipitation. That used to be how the Winter Armory shelter opened in Santa Cruz. Now it's open all winter, but the maximum at the shelter there is 75, although they sometimes cram in up to 100. I think the maximum, when it really got tough, they put in 125, but the maximum is 75, at which point it's considered to be full, according to the former Homeless Service Center Director Ken Cole and his successor Doug Loisel here in Santa Cruz. And, of course, that's 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people, very few of whom are now seeking that armory shelter, except, of course, when it's raining, in which case there's more. But obviously that's a very small percentage of shelter available for the percentage of homeless people that are out there. It may be a case of language barrier. Homeless advocates were speaking from their albeit tattered hearts, while council members insisted that they were supportively doing the same. Their answers tended more toward more bureaucratic language spoken around City Hall. The council conferred with staff that a moratorium on the camping ordinance, even a temporary one for cold winter nights, was probably too simple of a solution. And as for their professed support for other measures to assist the homeless, well, let's just say that time will tell. From there, the council moved on at their February 2nd meeting to discuss public nipple exposure and defining a proper police reaction to those who had run naked with pumpkins on their heads. And that's not actually a joke. They considered a public nudity ordinance in Boulder, Colorado. And perhaps as a comic break, I may play a little bit of that, too, if I get desperate or jovial, as the case may be. So, The phone lines have not been ringing off the hook, so you can provide a cheery ding-a-ling to me if you'd like. It's 427-3772 is the call-in number here at Free Radio, 831-427-3772. But until I hear from you, let's hear more from the streets and see what's cooking at that end.
One of several, strumming in front of Dale Williams. His display device is at least 10 feet from a bench. Let's listen to this man strum his guitar. And he has a harmonica as well, I might add. Coming back from the library with some VCRs. Haven't you got a DVD player? What is this VCR stuff?
They don't have anything good on DVD. All they got is new crap, blowing up buildings and naked ladies.
My goodness.
This is good stuff. This is Rome, Power and Glory, and Riley H. the Spies, which is dynamite.
Sam Neill or something.
Sam Neill. Right?
Any reports from the street you've seen or observed? I looked back from Thursday night.
The police have it all under control. Everybody's been run off, so it's a naked city, you know.
You mean a clean and safe city is what you're saying?
No, just plain naked.
Naked.
Desde aquí está un hombre que quiere trabajar, pero no hay trabajo, ¿verdad?
Sí.
¿Cómo se llama usted?
Raúl.
¿Y Raúl, para cuántos meses no puede trabajar?
Ya tengo tiempo que no trabajo, un año.
You have the time, but there is no work for almost a year, ¿verdad?
Sí, ando buscando trabajo.
And you've been looking to work.
Sí.
Right.
Sí.
Tú estás en la calle en las noches para dormir. You're asleep outside.
Sí.
¿Problemas con la policía?
No. Simplemente buscar trabajo.
But no food. I mean, no work.
No working for me. Sí.
¿Alguien quiere decir alguna cosa a la gente? You want to say anything to the people?
Pues a la gente, pues deseo que esté bien, que algún día encuentren trabajo también como yo, porque la vida está un poco media difícil por la economía y por todo lo que pasa, y queremos que todo se mejore para toda la gente que estamos pues sin trabajar y la gente que también puede quedarme en la calle, y queremos que todo sea mejor este año, que todo esté bien.
You're hoping things are going to get better this year. It's been a crappy economy. You hope folks can get work, and that's the general gist of it.
Sí, porque la verdad es muy dura ahorita la situación para las personas, porque la verdad la gente va a se para en busca de trabajo y no hay trabajo casi. Está.
People look for work, but they can't find it. Again, we've been talking with.
Ya está bien así.
¿Su nombre es Andrés?
Raúl, nomás.
Gracias, Raúl.
Okay.
All right. Well, today is February 8th, I guess, 2010. I'm down on Pacific Avenue around 22, and I'm talking with
Jeremy Kasmer.
And Jeremy, I know we first spoke, Friday evening when you gave me a call on the phone.
Yes, we did. I had given you a call about a police brutality incident that happened to me on the other block across from the Regal Cinemas over there.
Cinema 9?
Yeah.
Actually, we're standing now in front of New Leaf. So I'm not sure if we're going to broadcast this or not, because you may have a lawsuit. And
no.
I'm assuming you have no criminal charges pending that you know of?
No, there is no criminal charges. The release papers are right here.
Let me take a look. We're looking at your papers here. You have a yellow release document here.
Yeah, and according to this document, it says that no other charges are being filed.
Certificate of release, Jeremy Kasmer, 2410, Santa Cruz Police Department. There's a detention only, not an arrest. Released by the Santa Cruz something sheriff's office by Mello 38, something like that, or Mello's 38. A correctional officer, person arrested was for intoxication only. No further proceedings are desirable. And it cites Penal Code 849.5. In the case in which a person is arrested and released and no accusatory pleading is filed charging him an offense, any record of arrest of the person shall include a record of release. Therefore, the arrest shall not be deemed an arrest but detention only. Well, you were only detained. You should be very happy, Jeremy.
Nah, if that was being detained, I mean, this was no detain. I was detained, yes, and held up, yes, but very violently and very brutally.
And this is a story which I wrote about on Santa Cruz Indie Media, which you can go to read about at www.indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. I haven't heard back from Jeremy in the last few days after the actual incident, which he described happened on February 4th. He did get back to me. He did talk at length with attorney Kate Wells. I actually interviewed him in person, as you can hear downtown. I'm going to actually hold off on this interview for the moment, because I want, frankly, if his allegations are accurate, I think it is an important opportunity, not only for, an attorney to make a little money, frankly, but it's an opportunity for the police department to get a wake-up call. And the only way police departments get wake-up calls in this city is if they start losing lawsuits. That really has an impact. I mean, it is true that I think publishing people's accounts and broadcasting their
their verbal accounts is an important aspect, and that usually I've been, you know, trying to get ahead of lawsuits, because lawsuits take months or if not years to go through the courts, and that may be the case with this suit. And if it does seem to be the case, I'll probably play this. Maybe I'll play this interview on Thursday, where I have another show coming up 6 to 8 in the evening on this coming Thursday. But until then, I want to kind of hold off because, not because I don't believe this man's account is credible, but because I think it's important to, well, perhaps this caller can tell us why it's important. Yeah. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, how's it going, man?
This must be Drum Circle Dave.
Oh, hey, am I on there? Hey, good morning, Santa Cruz. Hey, hey, Donna Deist.
Deist.
Yeah, getting her arm broken out there at Three Trees where there's only 20-minute parking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I saw her at the Drum Circle this last Wednesday, so she is around.
She is around. Yeah, I'm just
so
I'm not sure if her lawsuit
over might be pretty simple if you come to the Drum Circle. That is.
Well, actually, I've run into her. But she doesn't really have any new information she's given me. Although, I'm not really sure what the situation is. If you see her, ask her how she's doing with her lawsuit. So maybe we can.
Oh yeah, man, I will, man.
Get some more information that way. I mean, it may still be in the process of going through the courts.
What's going on with your court case, Rob?
Well, I have two court cases.
Sinister Singers.
The Sinister Singer Slaughter on in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz on January 6th.
Yeah.
We're going to court.
At the little marker where it says you can perform there.
You have the right to perform and speak and generally, use the public space anywhere up and down Pacific Avenue. Of course, they have a whole elaborate series of behavior rules about display devices and sitting and panhandling and all that kind of thing. But this is a special zone in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz created by former mayor and homeless basher Scott Kennedy. He wouldn't call himself a homeless basher, but I would call him that in terms of his laws.
Yeah.
He helped pass the first anti-homeless laws in 1994. That involved the sitting bans and so forth. But there was this zone set up in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which we don't really go to the so-called zones to do our protests. We go wherever it's appropriate. If it's in front of Bunny's Shoes, because Bunny's is helping
right.
to criminalize the homeless with a loss, with a, you know, an injunction against the two homeless musicians. If it's in front of Borders to do a cop watch. If it's wherever it happens to be, we go.
Right.
And often we'll sing songs like the song Downtown, which you've probably heard on the air and heard on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a Petula Clark song, you know, but we have our own lyrics, you know. When you're alone and rents are making you homeless, you can't always go
downtown.
Right. So this
Officer Harms or Wallace or whoever.
Actually Sergeant Harms is, I don't know if he's featured in the song or not, but.
He was
featured. I know that the song has acquired more and more verses as we moved along. It has 9 verses now. And we sang, Tony and I sang a number of the verses at this protest. And 2 people living upstairs declared that it was unreasonably disturbing noises, although it was in the middle of the day. And it was unamplified sound by us.
Yeah, just singing.
You know, we were just singing, and it was a political song. Yet the police took their criticism as a basis for shutting us down. First, they demanded we leave. We said, we'll sing more quietly. Then they said, okay, but that wasn't enough. So they wrote us $465 tickets.
$1,200 to boot, or more.
Right, if there were 4 people that were ticketed, and one of whom wasn't even present when any of this happened, she just came
up
to hear what was going on.
Right, the bystander got a ticket.
This is a story we've talked about on the air, and I actually wrote a fairly long account of it.
Not that you all weren't just innocent bystanders, you were.
Well, we were, you know, political.
All of you were innocent.
We were political protesters, but we were certainly not engaging in any behavior that was
no,
criminal.
You weren't bringing out Tommy guns and breaking glass.
No,
and,
we weren't even singing so loudly as to engage in unreasonably disturbing noises. And that, you know, is the strange kind of law that is now being used by a combination of police and private hecklers to drive away musicians from the downtown area. So. That's
which they're trying to all the time, except for the Drum Circle, because we have a makeshift permit that we hang on the tree?
Well, it's not your makeshift permit, I think, so much as the fact that the Drum Circle has showed that it is a... They're willing to come back again and again with community support, people from the Trash Orchestra, people from Huff,
yep.
Even the Raging Grannies showed up, I think, once to be supportive. And it's just, you know, it's such an obvious change in the face of Santa Cruz to crack down on a group of
it
musicians.
It sure is, to crack down on musicians on the mall. That's a big change.
Well,
man.
What I'm saying is that the Drum Circle has been able to maintain itself mainly because of the numbers of the people that are there and the proximity to the farmer's market. You
right.
have the farmer's market nearby, so the police embarrass themselves. When they call out the riot squad, they create a crisis.
Yeah,
and you know they reveal essentially the steel fist under the velvet glove, and that's pretty nasty.
Yeah, turning the city naked. Yes,
and that's not something
like
that doesn't create more business downtown, which is of course the great paranoid fear and demand and desire of the merchants. They're scared shitless about the economy and blaming everybody they can find in the area.
If it costs them a penny, they'll call a cop.
Well, they're not even, you know, they're looking for targets to excuse what's going on instead of the real realities, the economic realities around us, as well as the fact that they're...
Right, the blame game.
Yeah, well, I mean, I blame people all the time for different things, and I think accurately, mainly politicians and police, I try to do that with some...
For their heinous acts, yeah, sure.
Well, for specific behaviors that I think are adequately documented, that you have to call them to account for it. But to claim that homeless people on the streets are a main reason for your loss of business, although it's a, you know, it's hard to document one way or the other. You'll get people who say, I never come downtown anymore because of those panhandlers. And it's, I imagine for some people it's certainly true.
I don't know.
I haven't examined the business records of these. You know, it's hard to compare. And they're also sort of intangibles to consider. I mean, it's true, you know, they don't allow panhandlers in the Capitola Mall. Other hand, the whole ambiance of the Capitola Mall is much different than downtown Pacific Avenue. And the question as to what kind of a city we want is really the issue. And we as everybody, you know, merchants, businessmen, cops, homeless people, you know, UCSC students, the whole shebang.
Right.
And
if you have a college town, well, hey, you're going to have musicians, you know. You're going to have people on the streets, you know, gathering and talking. And, you know, I mean, they may be remunerating over a certain song they have to do for their professor in
class.
Well,
some have noticed a change in the downtown in the last few years or even the last few decades that there is a... Particularly recently, in the last year or two, that there has been a real decrease in musicians, in folks hanging out downtown who are...
Right. We can only show up where we know we won't get in trouble.
Well, you know,
because we play music.
You know, I don't see this clearly myself because, as I said at the beginning of the show, I tend to take so many reports from so many people that they blur together. And I don't get a clear picture of now and then. But other people I've spoken with do feel that there is a real drop in the number of performers. Although you'll find people who will perform for a little while, then the police will hassle them and they'll leave. And you'll find some real old-timers who will hang on no matter what. I mean, there's the 10 o'clock club in front of the New Leaf Market that shows up often, you know, some of them are alcoholics, some of them are... good performers, they just don't want to be driven away. They don't care how many tickets they get, I guess. I mean, they're not doing anything that's terribly wrong.
So they show up at like 10 p.m. to play?
Well, usually it's sometime between 8 and 11 they're playing. And when the police come, they usually disperse. I mean, they're told to go, they usually go. But the point is they haven't been driven away by this harassment. But more middle class or sensitive souls or people who value what they do or, you know, want to follow the rules begin to find it really difficult and discriminatory and arbitrary to do that, although not everybody does. There are people who are still here. who remain on the sidewalks nonetheless, in spite of the actions of people like Jeremy Nooner.
Nooner, huh?
He's the NextSpace CEO of the Coonerty organization, who held a meeting on Thursday night with the police to find something to do, some solution to deal with these homeless ne'er-do-wells.
Oh, so he's just looking for some little fly in the ointment to really start boiling over at all these acts of music and some type of wrongs against the community, right?
Well, according to the Sentinel on Friday, it was a below-the-fold story. The headline is Santa Cruz Merchants Looking at Ways to Help Polish Downtown. There's a picture of Police Department Lieutenant Rick Martinez speaking to downtown merchants. The negative image many shoppers, diners, and moviegoers have about safety downtown. Again, they say it's making the difficult task of surviving an economic slump much harder. We need to bring people back here. We can, if we get word out that we can get aggressive and make this happen, people will come back. NextSpace co-founder Jeremy Nooner and a guy called Gambino, I'm not sure who Gambino is, Nancy Gambino, manager of Noah's Bagels, organized a merchants meeting Thursday to look at ways they could help police enforce recent public nuisance ordinances designed to discourage aggressive panhandling, loud street music, and people presumed to be homeless from sitting for hours on a park bench, sometimes smoking cigarettes or marijuana. The gathering tapped into a long-standing debate in Santa Cruz about how to balance a desire to be welcoming and provide social services against a desire to maintain a vibrant, family-friendly downtown that's healthy for business. Of course, this paragraph includes all kinds of suppositions that it's somehow not healthy for business to have a downtown that's open to everyone. You just want to have a sanitized, customer-only downtown where people come to shop, buy, and leave, which
right.
is, I think, what the merchants are saying that is what they want. I'm kind of surprised that Nancy Gambino is involved in this because I played an interview last Thursday or last Sunday that had Boots on the Blacktop Brad, as I call him, as a local who's often sort of a longtime panhandler in front of O'Neill's, who's been there for years, who's kind of keeps an eye on things and is very colorful in his speech and really has an interesting, accurate account of things. He described how Nancy was very upset with Jeremy Nooner for harassing her employees who walked to the side streets to smoke. Nooner apparently doesn't like people hanging out in front of NextSpace, which is the second-story business on Cooper right off of Pacific, and he's been screaming at homeless people and calling them drug dealers and faggots, things of that sort. And we've tried to, you know, we actually videoed him doing some of this and audioed him doing some of this, and we'd hoped he'd kind of calm down, but apparently he's ratcheting it up and trying to organize more attacks on not just homeless people, but homeless advocates. Like we were right around the corner at the Bookshop Santa Cruz when we got the tickets that you and I were talking about,
yes.
Dave, on January 6th for Singing Downtown. We weren't just sitting there singing downtown. We were serving food to homeless people. We were also presenting petitions. We had signs showing and naming the homeless people that had died in the last year in Santa Cruz, the largest number ever, almost three times as many as died the year before. I mean, there is a real attempt to muzzle, shut up, and sanitize what's going on because I guess these folks, these Take Back Santa Cruz people, as some of them call themselves, are feeling empowered because of their budget cuts in the city, but not for the police, apparently, at least not very significantly. They're going to have more police running around, harassing more people, and the right to be left alone if you're poor is, you know, doesn't exist.
Well, that Take Back Santa Cruz crowd, that's just a bunch of crap, because Take Back Santa Cruz to me means free speech, San Lorenzo Park, sit-ins, love-ins, free concerts in the park. That's Take Back Santa Cruz to
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Whoever put that phrase out there and said, we need to do this, is an idiot, because they don't live in Santa Cruz.
They mean commercialize Santa Cruz and conservatize.
They just came into town.
It's commercialized and conservatized. And the interesting, you know, the distortion in this article, which is written by a guy who I called up, who has refused, or not so far returned my call, J.M. Brown, that's the Sentinel writer, he uses the word safety, but there's no stats indicating that the Pacific Avenue is any more unsafe than it ever was.
No, it
you know,
isn't.
That's the
and
point.
There hasn't been any shootings on Pacific Avenue, okay? There hasn't been any murders, I don't think, except, you know, there's been a lot of police harassment.
Well, this collating, you know, yeah, there's been a police harassment. It's unsafe for poor people.
You know, like, if you
want to
call,
a
start, it's the police hassling everybody.
I mean, aggressive panhandling, loud street music, smoking marijuana cigarettes or tobacco does not translate to a lack of safety. It may translate to a more tumultuous area, but there's no reports of increased assaults or burglaries or anything of that sort. That's why this is fundamentally deceptive and inflammatory and false, this kind of reporting. But it's something the Sentinel has done for decades, so we shouldn't be surprised.
Exactly, exactly. And by the way, there was a failed attempt to arrest someone at the drum circle last Wednesday.
Oh, let's hear about that.
Well, the failed attempt was that some kid was there, and I guess he had some smoking paraphernalia or something, and the policeman stopped because he saw a pipe or something, and he got out and he tried to arrest the person, I'm going to say. But I believe he was under 21. And
under 21 or under 18?
I think he was under 21, but
right.
Not an adult. Okay.
So what happened then?
They basically put cuffs on him, and then they uncuffed him, and they had to leave.
Why?
They had to go. They didn't have a case, really, you know, so.
What was the reaction of the drum circle folks?
We weren't there yet. This was news to me. I had just arrived, and someone came up.
So it wasn't when the drum circle was drumming. It was before you arrived.
It was just before I arrived, around 1 o'clock.
Normally the drum circle runs from, what, about 2:30 to 6:30 or 7 or 8:30?
I just wanted to show up, hang out, talk to people, see what was going on before, you know, it started, you know, just to, you know. And, you know, rumors that Suzanne, the drummer, had died had been, you know, voiced to me. But Suzanne's not gone or dead, everybody, okay? So that was just a rumor.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Has she gotten any tickets lately, do you know?
I don't know. I saw her just briefly that day and said hello, and that was about it. Yeah, I don't know if she has any more tickets.
Well, it's good to hear. Suzanne survives.
Santa Cruz, everyone. You know, the police need to stop ticketing people that are playing music. They just need to stop it because if they go back in time, there are movies made of Germany when it was in its full swing, that's what was going on there, you know, repression and, you know, things like that, you know?
Well, maybe if these musicians played some good Nazi, or I should say some good American tunes, you know, I mean, something patriotic to kind of stir our troops in Afghanistan, maybe people would be feeling better. What do you think?
Well, yeah, like Who Would Jesus Bomb songs?
That wasn't quite what I was thinking.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because that's patriotic to me.
Well, Drum Circle Dave, I think we're going to leave it there. I'm going to press on. Anything you want to conclude with?
Peace, Santa Cruz, and definitely watch those cops, man. They're out to give you a ticket if you play music or sing, from what I'm getting, and that's not right. That doesn't compute. This does not compute.
Well, Dave, you know, take a look online, if you ever go online, at Santa Cruz Indie Media. I've written a new story there, which talks about some strategies musicians may want to use to deal with police intrusions.
Exactly. Exactly. Police intrusion is what's happening on the mall.
And again, we're talking about police essentially acting as cover for cranky and essentially controlling merchants who want to expand, you know, their domain from their stores and from their residences, for people who aren't merchants but who are residents, onto the sidewalk, who
right.
want to somehow control
out to
behavior
the
out there.
In the street. That's right.
Anyway, thanks, Dave. I'm going to roll on you.
Easy, bro. Peace, Santa Cruz. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And phone lines are open, 427-3772. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is what I just said. And I thought we might get another call. I'm glad to hear that ding-a-ling. Hi there. You're on Free Radio with Robert. Who's this?
Yeah, in response to what Drummer Dave and you were talking about.
What is your name, caller?
I just want to say that I heard the musicians in question perform This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie, and it is on your tape. God bless you, Drummer Dave.
Yes.
I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, anonymous one. So, the difficult thing about showing any pattern of repression on Pacific Avenue is it's really very arbitrary, and it's a function of the whims of officers Warren and Winston and Wilson and Forbes and whoever's doing the ticketing, and also the whims of the merchants or the residents who've decided they don't like this particular behavior going on, and so they're going to use the police power to not even necessarily convict someone of it, but harass them so they have to go to court and essentially remove them from it and discourage them from being in the area because of the whole court process that is instituted. And that's the real danger. It's a difficult situation. I mean, if you're facing a $445 ticket every time you start to sing, that's bad news. I mean, you can always say, well, look, those other people sang and the police didn't do anything, and then the judge will look at you and say, yeah, but they weren't engaged in unreasonably disturbing noises, and you were. And you say, well, how do you know that? Well, some citizen thought you were. Well, that's not sufficient, Your Honor. Where's the proof? Well, and then, of course, the question will be whether the judges actually will require that the elements of the law be proved, and if you have an attorney, maybe they will, and maybe they won't. Or not? And that's an interesting question. So we'll see what happens. There are some court dates coming up. I believe there's a trial in March. The four people who got citations, one has a trial in March. Two are just beginning to get their court dates together. The third, I think the fourth hasn't gotten a court date yet. What we really need, of course, is some kind of an injunction banning the police from taking complaints against musicians unless the police officer have real reason to believe there's probable cause that the citation has some real merit, not simply the whim of the person in question. Like, are there other witnesses? Do they have any kind of audio recording that shows extremely loud, excessively loud noise? There has to be some other thing other than the opinion of a person that they just don't like the sound of the music outside their window with the window closed when they're trying to sleep during the day at 1:30 on a Wednesday afternoon or 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. So we need to also get the police to be even-handed so that they will also take a counter ticket that says, okay, we're giving you a ticket for excessive noise because we weren't here. We don't know if the noise was excessive or not. You say that's a false police report. Okay, we're giving them a ticket for a false police report because you claim these are all false facts that are knowingly false. Then, you know, you'll both have to appear in court on those different charges. And hopefully this would discourage both people from, you know, involving the police, but rather would encourage, let's say, a person who doesn't like the noise or the music or the political protest song to come down and say, I'm trying to sleep, can you keep it a little more quiet, which almost never happens. Instead, you get these people saying, leave or I'm calling the police, as though the public sidewalk is their property. In fact, we all live here. We are all a part of this community, and we all have certain basic rights. And, of course, once the police start pretending that some do and others don't, we're in a really dangerous position, particularly if this is being done by people with guns, badges, and a lot of financial and political power behind them. So, what are your thoughts? 427-3772 is the call-in number.
last time I did say I was going to finish up, I guess it was actually maybe it was a week ago. Let's see here. My goodness, where is this? It's not there. This must be... Is this it? Nope. I'm trying to find a... Ah, yes, I hear this is it. The mayor of Santa Cruz is Mike Rotkin. And Rotkin met with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, back in early January. We fired a bunch of questions at him. And I played that on the air, that the whole tape of that conversation. Some of the questions had to do with this issue of this bogus police use of the unreasonably disturbing noises law to eliminate drive-away poor and homeless musicians and political activists, or just political activists, musicians who aren't poor and homeless, to drive away anyone that they don't want down there or that someone doesn't want down there. Rotkin agreed to follow up on some questions, and I began discussing his answers, and I did that a little bit on the previous show. I'm going to go through some of his stuff now, run through some of the questions I asked him, and give you, in essence, the answers. I also put in a Public Records Act request to Sergeant Michael Harms, who's the son of the beat sergeant downtown, mostly around the citations that were given me and three others for singing political songs in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. And I wanted to just get some more details on what the standards are. You know, how loud can you really be? What are the procedures for a citizen's arrest? Things of that sort. And we brought Mayor Rotkin into the dialogue by asking him to look into some of these questions himself to make sure that the police were not giving citizens a heckler's veto, that is to say, the ability to say, we don't like this singer, get rid of him, and tell him if he doesn't leave, we're going to force him into court with a $445 ticket threat, and you'll do it any time we snap our fingers. In other words, what's the standard? Now, I had a similar problem with the Metro Police, you may remember, those of you who follow the show, about a year and a half ago, where the police supported a security guard who simply wanted me to leave the property because I was talking to two homeless guys, and he came up and wanted to talk to me, and I turned on my tape recorder and I asked him what his name was, because I had previously been treated in a somewhat cavalier fashion by one of his fellow guards about an hour before, when I informed him that they were blasting religious sermons out over the public loudspeakers, literally. That I finally got a supervisor to stop that, but I know I recorded the conversation because that security guard, the previous one, had ordered me off the property. This one, the second one, was able to, he said he wouldn't give me his name and he wanted me to stop recording. And I said, well, you know, I won't. And he then called the police, and the police enforced his citation to order me off the property, even though I was doing nothing criminal whatsoever. The fact that I was not jumping to the orders of a security guard who essentially wanted to privatize a public space, and also keep secret what was his own attempt to enforce his own sort of whatever he was trying to do with me. I wanted it to be public. I'm not interested in, if he wants to, you know, take me off in the corner and advise me of this threat or that threat, or if he's going around telling people to leave the property that he shouldn't be doing this to, I want it to be known publicly. That's really what my job is on the radio. Well, police officers, just as they took the citation for so-called, for this political singing issue about a month ago, they also took this citation for trespass because I declined to leave the property. I said, I'm finished my conversation. We're going to continue to talk here. This is a public place. Through a really bizarre process at the court, from a judge who obviously was more concerned with upholding a police officer's powers than a citizen's rights, that this ticket was upheld. Although I'm proud to say and glad to say that we went back 2 weeks afterward and did exactly the same thing as before, recording, talking to people, recording the security guard's comments. He adopted his public friendly face this time, and we weren't molested or disturbed. Now, I've repeated this story, I don't know, half a dozen times on the radio, but it does come up again in this context, because the issue for Sergeant Harms that I'd sent this Public Records Act request to, and he still hasn't responded to yet, is what are the standards the police department uses? I mean, does, you know, can a security guard do whatever she wants, and we'll back that up? can a merchant, you know, have somebody arrested for music, no matter how soft it is, if they say it's excessively disturbing noise, is that sufficient? And they're just going to throw people into court and require that whole process to go before a judge? And if they do that, why aren't they taking tickets from people on the street saying, this is a false police report, arrest this person or write them a citation for making a false police report? There's no, in other words, there's no equal process happening here. So I wanted to get, I asked Mayor Rotkin, what are Sergeant Harms' instructions to officers, what are their general orders in the police department regarding citizen arrests and tickets on infractions, and what is their policy specifically regarding so-called unreasonably disturbing noises ordinance, which is the law that is being used to go after musicians and political protesters. Does the Santa Cruz Police Department require officers to keep records of citizen complaints they get so that we know, you know, if there's one particular person who's complaining all the time? Do they require, does the police department require officers to keep a record of the contacts with street performers? So, in other words, we can judge, well, this person's complaining, and then does the police officer then go and act as the agent of this malcontented person and tell the person, you have to leave because so-and-so is grumbling about you, and if you don't, we're going to send you into court? How many times does that happen? Where are the records for that? Do they keep records? And then what are the threshold criteria for turning a complaint into a ticket? In other words, at what point will the officer say, what standards does she or he use to say, you know, this isn't a crime what they're doing? They're singing on the street. They're allowed to sing on the street. They have to sing so loudly as to violate the following law. No person shall cause, suffer, or make to permit noises or sounds to be made which are unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, or which are so harsh or so prolonged or unnatural or unusual in their use, time, or place as to cause physical discomfort to any person, and which are not necessary in connection with an activity which is otherwise lawfully conducted. Singing is a lawful activity. You need to make some noise in order to sing aloud, particularly if it's a political song, to be heard by passers-by. So the obvious thing a police officer could do to find out what's going on is they could ask another merchant nearby, is this music unreasonably disturbing to you or physically annoying? And if so, why didn't you call me? Or what's the story? Or let's say there's a flower shop, as there was next door to us when we were doing our singing. But no such research was done by the officer who ticketed us, as far as I know, although that's what we were trying to find out, if there was any kind of investigation done. That's part of the Public Records Act requests we're making. And we asked Mayor Rotkin to kind of, you know, find out himself. He's the mayor. Maybe he can find out more exactly. His response to all of that was, he didn't say there was any procedure, or he didn't tell us what the procedure was for police officers taking citizen arrests. He just said, if the complaint seems plausible and justified, that's the standard, he said. The response to citizens who are abusing their ability to have the police effect such arrests for them is in court. In other words, but it's not really, because it's only in court if the police officer agrees to take the ticket, because the officer is not agreeing to take our counter tickets, which say the person who's complaining about the musician is making a false police report. Please take that and go ticket the person for it. But the cop won't take that ticket. So obviously there's only, for one person, they're required to go to court. For the other, they have a free ride. And the people who have the free rides are the merchants, the residents, the people that the police hold seminars with and cozy up to as a way of cleansing Pacific Avenue of undesirable transient elements, to use an old phrase. Anyway, I'm giving you the Rotkin response that I got from the questions that we posed at the Huff meeting. He goes on essentially saying, leave it to the courts, and we rely on citizen complaints about abusive behavior. People doing illegal things cease their behavior when police arrive on the scene. You've got attorneys, so go talk to your attorneys. You can sue the citizen in question for making the complaint and the police for helping them. And he does say a group of people singing without amplification is unlikely to meet the test of the ordinance under which you said you were cited.
but I wasn't there and have no intention of substituting my judgment for that of the citizen who complained, the police officer involved, or the courts. Notice I didn't ask any real questions about our case. I asked, what are the general standards? And really, he didn't answer that question. He just made the general statement, if a complaint is plausible and justified, and that's pretty vague and pretty subjective and leaves things pretty much in the hands of the police officers. And to say, oh, go to the courts, is to essentially duck the question. And that's what Rotkin did, I think, in this case. He didn't answer any of those five questions. He actually did, I take that back, he did say that no, they don't keep a record of the complaints they get, and no, they don't make a record of the contacts, and no, there's no written criteria, it depends on police discretion. But I notice he doesn't have any criticism of that approach. You know, he doesn't ask for a record of how many such cases were actually resulted in convictions, and how many such resulted in complaints to the police department about their officer behavior. And that's one solution and one suggestion I'm having for folks to use is when you as a musician, you're told to move along, you see this happening, ask to talk to the sergeant, or come to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every Wednesday, 10:30 to 12:30 at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific. Or give us a call at 423-HUF, and we will give you a complaint form to fill out to the police department. It's not going to do any good in the sense that they will uphold their officers, but it becomes a part of their record for 5 years. And if enough of these complaint forms go in, it may have a deterrent effect. It also helps public defenders and attorneys who are trying to show that some police officers have a record of either false statements or excessive force or lying, same thing as false statements. I also asked the mayor on behalf of Huffsters and also because of my own interest another question. Let's see what my next question was. Are you willing to return, Mayor Rotkin, to the voluntary street performers guidelines by eliminating the move along your display device every hour if you're told to do so in order, or will you make an exception for street performers or political tablers? And Rotkin essentially said, he doesn't support removing the display device law. Street performers guidelines work great for the performers who are not causing problems and are useless for the ones who were and are. But he doesn't mention that there were no complaints that I saw of about street performers when they passed these laws in 2002 and 2003, and he voted for this, for essentially destroying the street performers' voluntary guidelines. There was an agreement between street performers that if somebody wanted the spot or wanted a person to leave an area because it was the same tune was getting on their nerves, they would say, starting from now, can you leave for an hour from now? And they'd agree. And it wasn't a legal requirement. It was just an informal community agreement. And it seemed to work well. And there was no documented evidence that I remember in 2002 of occasions when this didn't work. All we had was then council member Matthews' claim that, well, it wouldn't work if there were a problem. So they were essentially, what they really wanted to do is they wanted to move along panhandlers with cups and guitar, and they wanted to move along political tablers who were annoying certain merchants, I think. And that was the way they were going to do it, by making all display devices, which is to say anything capable of holding tangible things, is a strange phrasing, but it's like a table, a cup, or a guitar case. You have to move it every hour if a police officer comes up and tells you to do so, unlike almost any other city in the United States. They don't have such requirements. So it actually makes it not possible to do a boycott with a table in front of any particular business or a strike or a picket line involving that kind of any kind of display device. So it's our Mayor Rotkin, who's on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union, supporting the restriction of civil liberties in Santa Cruz. I also asked him, what's the status of his supposed proposal to set up a 24-hour bathroom in Santa Cruz? He says he's still working on it. Well, you know, work harder. People have to take a crap. I mean, the only 24-hour bathroom in Santa Cruz that's open to the public is the Homeless Service Center, or was,
because Doug Loisel opened it up, and I think Letitia Swartz kept it open. I don't know if it's still open, though. The fourth question I asked him was, what was his reaction to Boulder's latest reexamination of its sleeping ban? And I read you sort of a discussion of how the Boulder City Council in Colorado finessed the issue, and they're considering it, but they're still ticketing people. And Rotkin didn't get into the specifics of that. He just said, he talked about other cities with very different conditions make changes. Well, Boulder isn't a really very different conditions. It's a, you know, it's a sort of a destination city. He gets defensive and says, our ban has never been found unconstitutional. We do more than any other small city in America to provide services for the poor and homeless. You compare us to towns that are many times our size or are forced by the courts to remove laws more restrictive. You have a hard time finding a court that finds our complaint-based enforcement of our camping ban is unconstitutional. And actually, that's not in the law. It's not complaint-based, as I said at the beginning of this whole discussion about an hour and a half ago. Our sleeping ban, our code that makes it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night, makes no mention of complaints. Rotkin claims that's what the police department does it on the basis of, but they aren't required to do it, and it's completely officer discretion. Although he will claim that the police stats show that it's all done on the basis, or most of it is done on the basis of citizen complaints. I've never seen a really careful analysis of that data. I'm not saying the police department is lying about it, but I've often wanted to look at it more closely. For those who are interested, there is a meeting of the Public Safety Committee coming up, which is the committee that supposedly oversees the police and fire departments. And I think Rotkin still sits on that committee. It will be Monday, March 15th at 4 p.m., a month from tomorrow, in the room behind the council chambers, the council's, I guess, called the city council meeting room or something. So I'll be mentioning that as it comes up more closely. But the Public Safety Committee is a sort of a joke. And it meets in obscure times and places, and it's it's hard to get them to do anything about anything, or to even... Part of their meetings are often held in secret because they claim their personnel matters. Although I think usually most of the meetings are open, but this is a really pathetic substitute for the Police Review Board, which itself was very limited, which Rotkin voted to kill in 2003, instead appointing this auditor, Bob Aronson, who has made no public written reports in the last 7 years. Rotkin also, our mayor also was asked, I asked him, what was happening with the Santa Cruz Police Department policy on tasering, the number of times tasers were used, and in what circumstances in the last 2 years. Can you give me that report? His response is, he got back to me, he claimed on the taser issue over a year ago, but he didn't send me what it was he got back to me on. He says he will get me more current information next week, and this email was sent to me on February 5th. So next week would have been this last week. He hasn't sent me anything yet. Let's give him the benefit of another week, but we'll see. He did send me the information about the Public Safety Committee meeting in a month, for those who want to attend that meeting on March 15th at 4 p.m. In the room right next to the City Council chambers. He claims that the Santa Cruz Police Department has very strict guidelines on tasers, not used commonly. No evidence are used as a form of punishment. Not that many tasers. Complete records every time a taser is fired. Public Safety Committee and the council have access to any information they want. He's personally reviewed that information. He's satisfied tasers are only being used when the result will be less rather than more serious injury to officers and the people they use are used against. But you'll notice he says nothing about the specific questions I asked, which has to say, what's the policy on tasering? What's the written policy? What are the general orders? What are the number of times the tasers were used? And in what circumstances in the last 2 years? He just says vague general statements. Trust me, I'm the mayor. I get to see the records. You know, you don't need to. You're just an ordinary citizen. Yada, yada, yada. Not adequate at all, of course. and essentially a cover-up and a rubber stamp for the police department. But then again, Rotkin has always done that. Or let's put it this way. There was a time 27 years ago in 1982 when he supported a real investigation and trial of police officers who were engaging in the code blue assaults on homeless people. That was many years ago. Around the same time, he actually pushed for public pushed initiatives on rent control at city council. He's done no public work on either of those issues since then that I'm aware of. And if I'm wrong about that, please, any of his allies, friends, or critics, let me know. 423-4833 is the off-air number. 427-3772 is the number to call in on. I also asked Mayor Rotkin a couple other questions in an email. And I'm going to put this email online so people can know the mayor's response to these questions. And you can also read them at your leisure. Let's see here. I asked him about what the standards were at the Metro Transit Center, because in this case where I was arrested for, supposedly the ultimate conviction was because I was standing in front of the 7-foot-long Metro sign. The claim was the police officer asked me to move, although that's not audible on the tape, and I wasn't aware that he'd asked me to move. And it's ridiculous to ask me to move because there's no reason to move from the sign because it could be seen. It's a huge sign. You've seen it in front of Pacific Avenue. It extends 7 feet long. It's at a height of about 3 feet, and it's in 7 feet in two different directions. Put on this sort of marble or stone obelisk. So he also claimed that I wouldn't turn off a tape recorder, and the idea that that's a crime is also preposterous. So I wanted to find out what the current standards were at the Metro, because he was on the board of the Metro, as well as being the mayor of the city and on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union. Mike Rotkin is on the board of the Metro Transit Authority. And I asked him the following question. Are there specific limits to the grounds on which a security guard can order a member of the public to leave the Metro if he or she is not committing a crime? I mean, I was told to do so, I told him, for tape recording his contact with me and standing in front of the Metro Center sign and supposedly not moving when he asked me to do so. Were there any changes made in Metro policies other than clarification of the right to flyer? He had initially said flyering is prohibited at the Metro and then later corrected himself. Are you still on the board? If not, can you informally determine if there were any further limits put on security guard powers? And his response was lengthy. As I've told you now many, many times, he's such a patient, long-suffering guy, and this was not an issue that came up at the meeting at Sub Rosa's, for what that is worth. That's where we met and asked him these questions. Your version of the story is that you were arrested for trying to tape record a security guard. You are actually charged with other violations of the criminal code, actually trespass, not leaving the property when asked to do so. But the reason I was asked to leave the property, the security guard claimed in court, was because I was tape recording him and because I was blocking a sign and refused to move when told to do so. Although the sign was 7 feet long and could be seen without my moving anywhere, and there was no indication on the tape that I was asked to move. In fact, what happened was when he began to talk to me, I interrupted him and said, "What's your name?" He wouldn't tell me, and he told me to turn off the recorder, and I said, "No," and he said, "I'm calling the police," and I said, "Okay." And that's where it developed from. So Rotkin is wrong in his analysis of what happened, but the question wasn't about what happened in my case. The question is, what's the current policy? But notice that he shifts. He does not go into what the current policy is, or at least he's spending some time talking about the past. I do know you got your day in court, he writes. They found you guilty as charged. That is now long ago enough that I forgot what else happened, but I think you appealed the case and lost to the higher levels, too. Apparently, the court thinks you broke the law. I don't intend to second-guess that. So he wants to leave it to the courts. On the broader issue, okay, here we go, of security guard or police discretion, I know that you would like to constrain the ability of the security forces to do anything that is not spelled out in excruciating detail, but law enforcement necessarily entails the use of discretion in the interpretation of existing laws. The courts exist to provide a forum to limit abuses of this discretion, and God knows you know, and you have lawyers who will apparently defend you who know that it is possible to cast doubt on and overturn arrests that involve abuse of that discretion.
discretion. Notice so far, and we'll keep going, there is no answer to the question, what are the limits on police, the discretion of a security guard and the city police to arrest someone just at the wish of a security guard? In other words, are there rules? There has to be illegal behavior at the Metro. Are there other rules that maybe short of illegal behavior that someone can be asked to leave and then arrested for trespass? What are the rules? What are the restrictions? What are the rights of the public? That was the question that I was asked. Instead, he's saying, all you want to do is limit our police. You can take it up with the courts, is the short answer. Rutkin continues to write, I have to say that in general, I think our city police officers and transit security guards often err on the side of letting things slide that might be seen as infractions by the court rather than they apply laws in unreasonable ways. We are no doubt in disagreement about that, but that's my honest view of that matter. Again, he's not answering the question. So I do not favor more tightly tying the hands of law enforcement. I'm just asking what the guidelines are. I'm not asking to tie the hands. Again, he's putting it in he's reframing it, misstating what I'm suggesting or characterizing it in a certain way, but not answering the question, what are the limits? What are the guidelines? What can a police officer arrest you for anything they want? Can the security guard of the Metro say, you have to leave, I don't like the color of your shirt, or they don't have to say what it is, you're a troublemaker here, go. And if you refuse to go, the police officer comes and he says, this person refuses to leave, arrest them for trespass. And the police department will do so with a snap of the fingers in the same way that they will arrest you or cite you for singing a song that someone in the building doesn't like. What are the limits? What are the criteria we can use so that we can know what our rights are? I'm asking the mayor of our town, who's on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union, who's on the board of the Metro Transit Authority, and I'm getting this kind of a non-response. As mayor, I get about 20 to 1 letters, emails, and calls asking why our police and transit guards are not more stringent in their enforcement of laws against antisocial and illegal behavior downtown. Remember, I said illegal behavior is always cause for an arrest. The question is, does the security guard have the power to order you off the property if you're not engaging in illegal behavior? Tape recording somebody who comes up to you and is talking to you is not illegal behavior. Standing in front of a sign is not illegal behavior. Yet, that was the basis on which this police officer told me to leave the property. When I refused to go, I was arrested for trespass. So my question again was, what are the limits of the security guard? And his answer is, not to answer. So I think that is not just a matter of my personal view, but a question of how the local population, mayor continues, the Democratic voters see the matter. If I thought they were being unreasonable, even if they were the majority, I might not support their concerns. But in general, I think that our balance of how we enforce ordinances downtown is pretty good. And that if anything, we do not stop enough unacceptable behavior downtown. So is he saying that anything a security guard finds is unacceptable, it's okay for the police to endorse it and arrest, and that the only check we're going to have is in the courts later on as a judge somewhere down the road? Or is he saying that there are standards which the Metro Transit Board tells its security guards, you can't arrest someone unless either they're engaging in criminal behavior or they're doing some other things that aren't criminal but that are a particular violation of certain rules and policies at the Metro? I was violating no rules or policies at the Metro. We had the rule or policy book out there in my trial. No policies or rules were violated. And yet, of course, the judge found I was guilty. It was a very bizarre situation. That thing is, by the way, online, that discussion. We have a transcript of that entire trial, which cost an arm and a leg. And it was quite a fraud. And it's interesting how this all works together to say to the police, do what you want. And that is a really dangerous situation. But again, I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't circumstances in which a police might use broad discretion to do something, but there should be some guidelines. And I'm asking what those guidelines are, and all he's saying is it's a police discretion. He's not saying specifically what the guidelines are at the Metro, and he should know because he's been on the board for a decade or more. He continues to say, as you know, rather than asking people who believe that our police and transit guards are too strict or discriminatory in their handling of citations and interactions with police downtown to rely on my view of that matter or yours, I say they should go look for themselves and see if it appears that we are trying to drive all the homeless people out of the downtown. I know that you and your friends think that this is the case, but the vast majority of local citizens, including UCSC students, who are generally sympathetic to the poor and the homeless, take the other view. I haven't polled the students. I don't know. But again, this isn't about my question. It's an, you know, it's another issue. It's an important issue. The question is, what are the standards, not just for homeless people, not just for, you know, political activists or reporters who happen to wander into the metro and whom a security guard, you know, decides they don't like, but any or any person walking through, what are their rights in the metro? I mean, what are the security guards' powers there? What are the expectations of the public there? And I'm not getting the answer. It's interesting, though, that there is a law at the Metro Transit Center that is much stricter in terms of its restrictions on police behavior than, let's say, for a private business. Though I was arrested for refusing to leave a private business at the Metro, though I was standing on 3 feet from the sidewalk in the entrance area of the Metro off of Pacific Avenue. That law states you have to be given a hearing. You can't be told to leave unless you're engaging in behavior that is, I think it's violent or disruptive. I've got to look for the exact wording. It has to be in danger, I think, the safety of, there has to be, in other words, it's a standard that's slightly below illegal. It might not be illegal what you're doing, but there has to be some really significant disruption occurring before that can happen. And I wasn't charged under that law, because if I were, I wouldn't have been convicted, because standing in front of a sign is not, that you're not blocking, does not constitute disruption. It's simply a pretext for a police security guard to tell you to go because they don't like your attitude. And bad attitude is not a basis for telling someone to leave. Particularly if, you know, they are critical of your performance. I was critical of how the security guards were behaving that day. I didn't think it was good. And I've discussed that at length online. If you want to get more about this, hear more, read more about this, you can go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, and you can search for Norse and go back and look at the past stories about the Metro Transit Authority. This is a place that everybody has to use, or many poor people have to use. It's the buses. It's being cut back more and more. And therefore, it's really an important public hub. Not a private business. It's a public hub. And for, you know, to use these kinds of weaselly excuses for the police department behavior is really unbecoming of a mayor, unbecoming of a police department, unbecoming of the Metro Board, and certainly unbecoming of the ACLU Board of Directors. You know, it just doesn't, it's just bad news and speaks badly about what's happening in Santa Cruz. Rotkin writes more, I remain open to hearing about particular new cases of what you believe are abuses and will take them on with fresh eyes and an open mind. Everyone, including our police, is capable of making mistakes, and I don't want to presume there's ever an injustice occurring. However, to be honest, your credibility on this issue is not high with me or many others in the community. Again, no answer to what are the standards at the Metro Center, Mr. Metro Transit Board guy, Mr. Mayor, who oversees the police department on the Public Safety Committee. Nothing there. And it's not about my credibility. There's a tape of the entire thing, which is online. He doesn't have to believe anything I say. He can listen to what went down. He has refused for the last year and a half to do that. So it's just a political brushing off of the issue and defense of the police department. And that, of course, is standard Rotkin position, unfortunately. I am still on the Metro Board. Let's see. I think you have basically wrung as much political mileage as you're going to get out of your bust at the transit center. I don't know about that. But you are, of course, free to continue to complain about it in every forum you can find. Just don't waste my time by bringing it up to me again. Thanks. Actually, I will. I'm going to write him back saying, thank you for your lengthy answer. Now answer the question. What are the limits on security guards specifically? Can they arrest people for behavior that is not illegal? And if so, are they required to use the code section that actually refers to the Metro and doesn't refer to private businesses? That was the issue in my case, which the judge misruled on, and which he refused to answer, or at least didn't answer. I am still on the Metro Board, writes Mayor Rotkin in his email back to me. I am unaware of any other discussions on the issue of security guard discretion other than the one time I've already mentioned to you, and frankly, I'm the only member of the board even willing to entertain such a discussion. You know, so I'm your only buddy on the board, is what he's saying. With such friends, we need no enemies. The unanimous view is that there is a need for stricter enforcement against antisocial behavior that makes bus riders feel uncomfortable. I got two letters about that issue today alone. There's no indication that anything I did made anyone uncomfortable except the security guard, but that's not the issue. My case is not the issue. Complaints about the police are not the issue. Complaints about security guard are not the issue. The issue is, what are the standards for people walking into the metro to understand what they are required to do, what rules they are required to follow, what their rights are when they walk through if a security guard doesn't like the way they look, doesn't like the way they act, for some reason wants to move them along because of a directive from his boss, or for whatever reason, doesn't like the way a reporter is investigating, which is what I was doing. Does that person have the power to do that, even if the person is doing nothing illegal? And if so, what are the standards they're supposed to use? That's a question I'm going to repeat again. I'll get back to you if I get an answer from Mayor Mike Rotkin. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. And I think I may have a little tune here to break up the endless drone of my voice. I think I'm going to play a song from Carol Denny's album, You're Spending Too Much Money on Your Hair. It's called Don't Try to Tell Me the News.
Calm, aware, but they don't know for how long. The experts and the analysts.
was Don't Try to Tell Me the News on Carol Denny's fairly older album from 2004, You Are Spending Too Much Money on Your Hair.
Whoa.
I'm Robert. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm at the Free Radio Secret Studio location, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. You can call in and chat with me at 427-3772. You can call in and leave a message for the entire collective or a donation or a question about other shows or public service announcement at 427-4523. I'm going to repeat these numbers at the end of this announcement so you can pick them up in case you want to get a pencil. You can also send a donation to us at Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7811. 95061 in Santa Cruz. That's Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office Box 7811 and 95061 in Santa Cruz. And we are online at freakradio.org. That's one of the best ways to reach us. You can get the schedule there. I think it's been updated, hopefully. And you can also give us money, equipment, cheers, brick bats, you name it, whatever feels appropriate. Again, the numbers to call, 427-3772 is the on-air number, area code 831, of course, 831-427-FRSC 3772. You can also try the voicemail line if you would like to leave a message at 427-4523. If you want to catch me off-air, try the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. Which translates as 4833. And you can send your massive $1,000 checks to Post Office Box 7811 95061 in Santa Cruz. Any questions about that? If you leave a question, I'd say try the voicemail line 427-4523 and someone will get back to you. So, there's about 50 minutes left in the show. That's 50 minutes left. If you're interested in calling in, you better call in fairly soon. I'm looking over some of the local. Well, on this show, I haven't mentioned, except briefly, the ongoing slaughter in Afghanistan, Iraq, and points in the Middle East. The Obama wars, which all the fans of Obama, and for that matter, their Republican critics, most of them, are not paying any attention to, but I think need to be attended to. Here's a brief story from antiwar.com, The Seven Paragraphs That Shook U.S.-UK Ties, by William Fisher. Yesterday's story. A British court has ordered the publication of previously secret information that appears to reveal the United Kingdom government's complicity with the U.S. in the torture of Binyan Mohammed, a British resident who was imprisoned by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The decision by the English Court of Appeals affirmed an earlier High Court ruling that ordered the release of seven paragraphs that the British government had sought to suppress because the administration of U.S. President Barack Obama, quote, explicitly threatened that the publishing the information would harm the intelligence-sharing relationship between the two nations. British Foreign Secretary David Miliband argued that the publication of those seven paragraphs would endanger Britain's national security. But as the Court of Appeals noted in their decision, the information at issue had already been placed in the public domain through a U.S. court decision in November 2009. In that case, the judge, after reviewing extensive evidence of Mohammed's allegations of torture, noted that the government did not challenge or deny the accuracy of Binyam Mohammed's story of brutal treatment. Jonathan Evans, Director General of the British Intelligence Service, MI5, denied his staff had withheld documents relating to Mohammed from the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee, the ISC, or sought to cover up its involvement in the torture of detainees. Evans said the claims by the Master of the Rolls, Lord Neuberger, that there was a culture of suppression within the service were the precise opposite of the truth. In an article in the UK's Daily Telegraph newspaper, Evans wrote that MI5 was trying to protect the country from, quote, enemies who would use, quote, all the tools at their disposal, including propaganda, to attack. We will do all that we can to keep the country safe from terrorist attack. We will use all the powers available to us under law, he wrote. MI5 told the
ISC, and that's the Parliamentary Committee Investigating Torture and the lies that led up to the invasion of Iraq. Mohammed was interrogated, quote, in line with the service's guidance to staff on contact with detainees. Notice all these gentle words about torture. Torture and unlawful imprisonment, kidnapping, and so forth. However, a seven-paragraph summary released by the appeal court shows that the CIA told MI5 Mohammed had been subjected to continuous sleep deprivation, threats, and inducements. While Mohammed's case has wound its way through the English courts, he has also sought justice in the U.S. courts as lead plaintiff in the lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union against Japosin Data Plan, a Boeing subsidiary. That lawsuit, Mohammed versus Japosin, charges that Japosin knowingly participated in the CIA's forced disappearance and torture of Mohammed and four other men through the provision of critical flight planning and logistical support services to the aircraft and crews used by the CIA in its extraordinary rendition program. The Obama administration has sought to dismiss the Japosin case at the very outset by invoking the state secrets privilege, claiming that allowing the case to proceed will endanger national security. Last December, the case was reheard by a panel of 11 judges in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Their decision is pending. Asked by IPS, the British Parliamentary Committee investigating, about the English court decision to release the seven-paragraph document, ACLU staff attorney Ben Wisner said, never before have so many high-level officials worked so hard to suppress what everyone already knew. Think about it. Here we have two heads of government, two secretaries of state, the chiefs of two intelligence services, and many others at the highest levels of government, all conspiring to hide information that was in plain view. The only remarkable thing about the released document is how unremarkable it is, he added. The document, he told IPS, the parliamentary group, has nothing to do with protecting national security. It has only to do with preventing legal accountability for torture. But the wall of impunity is crumbling. Wisner told IPS that the ACLU would file a new motion to call the attention of the Ninth Circuit judges to the British decision. Binyan Mohammed was under the control or in the custody of U.S. authorities for 7 years before his release back to his home in England in February last year. The released paragraphs confirm Binyam's torture, referring to his sleep deprivation, his threat to disappear him, the fact that the interviews were having a marked effect on him and causing him significant mental stress and suffering, and the fact that the reports provided to the SYS, I'm sure what that is, made clear to anyone reading that he was subjected to the treatment that we have described and the effect upon him of that intentional treatment. U.S. officials played down claims that the appeals court disclosure of CIA information passed to MI5 would damage intelligence sharing with Britain as fresh doubts emerged about the accuracy of information given to the British Parliament. But Ben LaBolt, a White House spokesman, said the U.S. was deeply disappointed in the court judgment. We shared the information in confidence and with certain expectations, he added. Another White House official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the court decision would not provoke a broad review of intelligence liaison between Britain and the U.S. because the need for close cooperation was greater than ever. The British government has indicated it will not appeal the judgment. Mohammed's lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, director of the legal charity Reprieve, said, our government went to enormous lengths to prevent the British public from seeing this tiny fraction of Binyam's story. They still refuse to admit he was abused. Today's decision is very welcome, but the paragraphs revealed are only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to British complicity in torture. Much more is to come. And these are the redacted paragraphs. It was reported that at some stage during that further interview process by the U.S. authorities, Binyam Mohammed had been intentionally subjected to continuous sleep deprivation. The effects of the sleep deprivation were carefully observed. It was reported that combined with the sleep deprivation, threats and inducements were made to him. His fears of being removed from United States custody and disappearing were played upon. It was reported that the stress brought out by these deliberate tactics was increased by him being shackled in his interviews. It was clear not only from the reports of the content of the interviews, but also from the report that he was being kept under self-harm observation, that the interviews were having a marked effect upon him and caused him significant mental stress and suffering. We regret to have to conclude that the reports provided made clear to anyone reading that Binyam Mohammed was being subjected to the treatment that we have described and the effect upon him of that intentional treatment. The treatment reported, if it had been administered on behalf of England, would clearly have been in breach of the undertakings given by England in 1972. Although it is not necessary for the U.S. to categorize the treatment reported, it could readily be contended to be, at the very least, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment by the U.S. authorities. These were the paragraphs suppressed by the courts, but now revealed. This is a story at antiwar.org, The Seven Paragraphs That Shook U.S.-UK Ties, by William Fisher, published yesterday. Torture continues. And here is another story. By Barton Hinkle, Obama takes a blue pencil to the Bill of Rights. No more illegal wiretapping of American citizens. This administration acts like violating civil liberties is the way to enhance our security. It is not. That was Barack Obama, but that was on August 1st, 2007, 2 years before he took office. On second thought, never mind. With the world's attention riveted by the earthquake in Haiti, few noticed that when late last month a federal judge took a pair of sharp scissors to the Bill of Rights. But on January 22nd, Federal District Judge Vaughn Walker agreed to dismiss a lawsuit over warrantless wiretapping, as the administration, the current one, had requested. The suit was the second of its type to get tossed out. The first suit was filed against AT&T, and it accused the company of forking over to federal agents the calls and emails of customers in the United States. But Walker dismissed that suit last June after Congress passed legislation granting, that's a Democratic Congress, folks, retroactive immunity to telecom companies for cooperating with federal surveillance efforts. The second suit was filed against the National Security Agency. Walker threw it out on the grounds that the plaintiffs could not show that they had been individually harmed because they could not, quote, differentiate themselves from the mass of telephone and internet users in the United States. They needed a direct personal stake to claim standing for the right to sue, not merely a right to have the government follow the law. This seems to suggest that as long as the government is hoovering up vast amounts of communications records from many thousands of Americans, dragnet surveillance, no harm done. The more people the government wiretaps, the more authority the federal government has to do so. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Robert. This is John Tilkin calling from San Jose.
Hey there, Dangerous John. What's the word?
Oh, I just had a comment to add to your diatribe about Obama.
Okay.
I was wondering if you happened to review the email that I sent you about the Democracy Now! Segment on assassination of U.S. citizens by CIA, I guess it is. Basically, they're taking the gloves off and saying that it's okay for U.S. forces to assassinate U.S. citizens overseas.
I haven't reviewed it, but I've read about it elsewhere. I think I may have seen it when it was, or heard it when it came up. Maybe I did review it, but I haven't reviewed it in the last day or two, anyway.
Okay.
But yeah, no,
anyway,
that
it's still at the theoretical stage because I haven't heard of anybody actually being assassinated versus the actual torture that goes on. You know.
Oh, it's happening all the time over with these drone attacks. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, attacking U.S. citizens specifically.
Right. We don't know, but they're saying it doesn't matter if a U.S. citizen's there; we'll kill them anyway.
Yeah.
Right. It's that is, of course, we've been worried about, you know, habeas corpus. He won't be taken to a court. We've been worried about you'll be held and tortured for 7 years. Now, all that worry is obviously not a problem because they'll just shoot you. quietly.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, these are practices that have been pioneered by Mao's China and, you know, Stalin's Russia and Hitler's Germany and, I don't know, more recently, I'm sure, in other countries. So it's, you know.
Of course, I should point out that that was a policy of the Bush administration. I'm wondering why it wasn't discussed when Bush was in office.
Well, it was a policy of the Bush administration, and it was good propaganda to get Obama into office, wasn't it? You know, you can rant and rave about it all you want. Once you get in office, however, hey, it's a nice tool to have, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's the question is, what are we going to do about it? You know, I mean, if you talk about assassinating the president, it's 10 years in jail. If they talk about assassinating you, it's fine. And if they do it, it's fine, apparently. So we talk about it, we get jail, they talk about it, you know, they get higher office, or, you know, they get nothing.
Yeah.
It's not good. Obviously, these are the times that try men's souls.
So anyway, if people want to review the discussion on Democracy Now! Sometime last week, it was on Democracy Now! It's one of the headlines on the current website.
Sure. I mean, the real question is, we know about it. Now what do we do about it? You know, do we set up camp outside the federal government demanding this change? What do we do that stops the operation of this procedure? Because that's what we need to do. We can talk about it all we want on the radio. I guess that's one way we can inform people about it. But you're going to get people saying, well, you know, Obama inherited Bush's war, and, you know, there's not much he can do. And it takes time, and, you know, I mean, and there is a national security emergency on. I mean, after all, you know, there's a war on. You know, you'll hear all this. So but more than that, we have people who were all fired up to do something about this when Obama was not in office, and now have no interest whatsoever in doing anything about it.
Right.
They're all into health care or global warming, you know, or, I don't know, harassing the homeless downtown. I don't know. I would suppose that's not necessary. Although, that's interestingly enough, some of the people who oppose Bush, you know, these Coonerty Democrats are also up for harassing and poor and homeless people downtown who and stiffening the laws that criminalize survival behavior in the Santa Cruz area.
Okay, well, that was my one concern that I wanted to be sure you were of.
Thank you, John.
Talk to you later.
All right, man. Bye-bye. So, got about 35 minutes left. The call-in number is 427-3772. And I do have a couple of a couple of coughs to give you here. If I can stop coughing. There's an interesting article which I picked up this morning and sent out over the Huff email. Advocate for Sacramento homeless sues city over camping ordinance. And Sacramento, actually, this is Mark Marin, who's an attorney. He let the homeless camp on his property last fall, and they went after him for doing that. Though they dropped the charges against the homeless people, the homeless started moving from place to place as sort of a moving campground. I'm not sure. I hadn't heard more from the so-called safe ground movement that the Sacramento homeless were doing. But apparently, and there was supposed to be some deal with the city because Marin had sued the city and the county for their sleeping bans way back in 2008, I believe, maybe even 2007. I think it was 2008. And he got some kind of a settlement with the city. But apparently that ain't working, because here's the news story. City police violated the constitutional rights of homeless people by repeatedly rousting them from a rogue campground last summer, a lawsuit filed Monday in Sacramento Superior Court charged. The suit, filed on behalf of 23 homeless men and women by civil rights lawyer Mark Marin, asks that the city stop enforcing its cruel and inhumane anti-camping ordinance and seeks unspecified monetary damages. It names the city of Sacramento and the Sacramento Police Department as defendants. Among the plaintiffs is Michael James Mazika, 46, who recently died in part because of his long-time exposure to the elements, Marin said. Other plaintiffs are in temporary winter housing
or sleep along the rivers, on sidewalks, or on the streets, he said. At least 1,200 men, women, and children sleep outdoors in Sacramento on any given night because of a shortage of shelter beds, the suit estimates. Because the city prohibits camping for more than 24 hours at a time in undesigned areas, they are forced to move from place to place to avoid arrest, the suit says. Last summer, about 30 people set up a makeshift campsite at a lot Marin owns near 12th and C Streets. For about 3 weeks, police raided the encampment, seizing tents, sleeping bags, and other property, and detaining and citing homeless people. The camp disbanded after city leaders, including Mayor Kevin Johnson, pledged to find a solution, including the possibility of establishing a legal, safe campground site with basic services. As of this week, said Marin, and I remember playing the actual account from Mayor Kevin Johnson saying you would have something in place by the spring. He even came out to show his solidarity with the homeless and spent a night with them. What a sweet guy. As of this week, said Attorney Marin, the city has done nothing to address the long-term issue, although Johnson did find temporary winter shelter for about 300 homeless people. I'm very frustrated by how the city has handled this, said Marin. Anything that we accomplish, we're going to have to get through the courts and from private folks who want to contribute to the safe ground cause, he said. The city attorney's office and assistant city manager Cassandra Jennings declined to comment on Marin's lawsuit. We haven't seen or been served the document, and we typically don't respond to legal matters, said city spokeswoman Amy Williams. Police spokesman Sergeant Norm Leong declined to comment on the suit. He said officers will continue enforcing the camping ordinance. That hasn't changed. The lawsuit accuses the city of false arrest, arguing that the camping ordinance is enforced only against homeless people. It asks the court to force the city to stop enforcing the ordinance because it criminalizes homelessness, deprives homeless people of their rights under the California Constitution to freedom of travel, equal protection and due process of law, and is unconstitutionally vague. Interesting arguments that were used about 16 years ago in the Tobe case, but not successful at the California Supreme Court level. It is not a health and safety, as the city has stated. It is a tool to control the homeless, Marin said. He said similar but less draconian ordinances have been successfully challenged in court in other cities, including Los Angeles and San Diego. The goal of the suit, said Marin, is recognition by the city that homeless people can be outside, that they stop arresting them and taking their stuff, and sanction an area where they are allowed to be. The stakes are high, Marin said. He said Mazika, the man who died, had various health problems, including AIDS and diabetes. He was a sick man and was doing very poorly outside, he said. When your health is fragile, you need a place that is calm and where you can relieve stress and deal with your health problems, not be constantly focusing on where you might rest at night. Mazika spoke at meetings about the need for housing. In December, he became one of several Safe Ground leaders to receive a motel voucher for shelter throughout the winter. He died in the motel a few weeks later, Marin said. When your health is fragile, you need a place that is calm and you can relieve stress and deal with your health problems, not be constantly focusing on where you might rest at night. And I sent out this story. This is in Sacramento. And there's an interesting whole series of comments that follows this story, a lot more sympathetic to homeless people, although you get your mass of bigots and know-nothings as well, as you do on Sentinel stories. And the Sentinel story I mentioned that came out on Friday, which again sort of tears the mask, the smiley mask off the downtown merchants at Noah's Bagels and at Next Space, Jeremy Nooner and I guess Nancy Gambino. Too bad. I like patronizing Noah's. I may have to rethink that. But here's some of the interesting comments that follow this story. I dispute your opinions and pseudo-facts that homeless refuse help. Apparently he's talking about one of the... Actually, I've skipped ahead to a comment, but let's see what this comment says. I believe I am well-versed to speak on the issue as I have logged thousands of hours working with the homeless on the underlying issues of why they became and continue to be homeless. What I've found is that narrowing the complexity of homelessness down to laziness hang on here I
just lost my story for a moment. Don't go away. You can find it. Where is it? Come on, baby. Wish my computer didn't jump as much as it does. I think I need a better mouse. Don't go away, folks. What I found is that narrowing the complexity of homelessness down to laziness and declining help are typical convenient and erroneous beliefs held by the uninformed and ignorant. The real issues are, in no particular order, mental illness, addiction, childhood abuse and neglect, severe trauma including rape, molestation, incest, and so on, domestic violence, head trauma, physical disability, lack of social supports, lack of jobs paying living wage, lack of affordable housing, etc., etc. Let me know when you want to acknowledge the real issue. I'd say this for the downtown merchants as well. There are other comments that follow. City officials have had long months to address this horror and avoid a lawsuit. They just didn't bother. They had plenty of warning. And if you read the links I posted in my earlier comments, you would know that the in-your-face panhandlers are now just the tip of the iceberg. The rest are doing everything they can to look like normal people and to stay out of everyone's way. Parents don't want to risk having their children disappear into the foster care system, and we've all heard what that's like lately because of the situation they hope is temporary. Meanwhile, on the other side, we have someone writing, what the city really needs to do is to pass an ordinance that effectively will close down Loaves and Fishes, which is the organization that supports homeless people, or at least move it out of Sacramento. And then another person asks, the same person actually, isn't Marin, the attorney, violating the settlement he reached with the city some weeks ago when the city agreed to drop its enforcement of the ordinances against him and the campers if they would leave, which they did? Of course, these are looking for people to disappear. You can't disappear in a city where there's no place to go. This is going to be a battle of attrition, writes another person. The city will cave in eventually if Marin keeps the pressure on. Marin does not lose many battles. And here's someone on the other side, the side I'm not on. Here is the deal. Yes, the truly needy homeless need assistance and social services. No one will argue. However, the problem is the majority of these people refuse help, refuse shelter, and do not want your help. I don't believe this to be true, but continuing. I know this firsthand because I worked around the homeless in this area for years. Further, when the unemployment rate in the greater Sacramento area was around 5%, Attorney Marin was still doing nothing to solve the problem, doing nothing to work with local officials to resolve this issue, and was filing lawsuits. And, of course, my question would be, what does he mean by solve the problem? You know, the final solution to the Jewish question for some in Germany was deport them to Madagascar or burn them up. Get rid of them. And that's, of course, the kind of talk we're hearing. Get rid of them. Harsher ordinances, more police enforcement. Downtown Santa Cruz. Interesting stuff happening in Sacramento. Here's another comment. I'm a little depressed over the callous comments on the Marin story. Letting the newly or occasionally homeless have a place in our community puts them in one location where service providers can help them back on their feet. For families, it may be just one member who brings them down. Does it make sense to persecute them all? When they have safe ground, law enforcement doesn't have to be all over the city to watch them. They're in one or two places and can focus there with fewer officers. Again, a little concentration camp mentality here. But for the chronically homeless, it is cheaper to put them up in minimally adequate motel than pay for their constant emergency room medical bills from being exposed to the elements or being abused. Can you set your indignation down for a moment and wrap your heads around that? No, I'm not inviting any homeless persons into my home yet, but how long can we do nothing? Thank you, Mr. Marin, for repeatedly doing something. Marin actually set up a lot where people could come and tell the neighbor went after him for having homeless people on his lot, not because of any particular specific problems, but just on the basis of a generic city law, which is what, of course, is used against homeless people in Santa Cruz. It's not that people are creating litter or crapping on the ground or screaming all night or, you know, cutting down trees or having a dangerous fire. It's that they're sleeping there nearby. We don't want them there, is the continual cry of the bigots, the fearful, the paranoid, the privileged in Santa Cruz, as in all these other cities. And in order to fight that, we have to mobilize. We have to fight back. We have to get together. We have to actually do the kinds of things that they're doing in Sacramento, that they did in Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, and other cities. And that remains to be done here in Santa Cruz. If you're interested in fighting back, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And here's some more from Sacramento. I know for a fact that Attorney Marin has homeless people at his house where his family lives. Let the facts soak in and deal with it. Safe ground is such a radical concept. Imagine, these homeless people are asking for a field. Yes, a field where they can sleep without getting arrested. Such audacity. Stepping up and fighting for the least among us, I applaud and am inspired by you, Mr. Marin. Mark Marin has homeless people sleeping in his house, so get over it, people. He is devoted to the issue in a selfless way. And here's a sort of a half-critic. Mark Marin is a pain in the posterior, and certainly the homeless beggars seem to be multiplying, whether tearing at our hearts or stirring our righteous wrath. He may be on firm legal footing in this matter. The law does seem vague and punitive to a class of people. He most assuredly is needed to keep the city of Sacramento honest in the ways police and courts deal with these people and try to address the problems. I'm sure he could tell you the quickest way to be done with him is to acquiesce to the legal campsite proposal, but maybe someone has a better idea. If Mr. Marin owns the lot, this is the parking lot that Marin allowed the homeless on, but they were forced off because the neighbors and the police started arresting them on the neighbor's complaint that they were just violating the city law, not that there was anything else happening. I don't care if it's in Alcali Flat or wherever. He should be allowed to provide a place for the homeless in these terrible times, and the city should step up and help him care for the least of these, as is the most basic human charge. It's not like these people are camping on some unknown person's land. Our shelters are full, people. They need some place to go. These are not ordinary times. The loss of a job now can mean months of unemployment. What should they do? Someone tries to help, and he's not even allowed. And this goes on. This is an interesting article. Again, if you want to be on the Huff email list, do give a call or send me an email at rnorris3@hotmail.com. I'll put you on the Huff email list. You can also give a call to 423-HUFF if you want to be helpful in any way. And again, you don't have to go really public or at risk arrest or anything. We didn't think we were risking arrest when we sang songs in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz. We'll be fighting that and becoming back to the Bookshop Santa Cruz. I promise you that. Give a call, 423-HUFF, if you're interested. This is free radio you're listening to, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, and the call-in number is 427-3772. Not much time left, but another interesting story out of Gainesville. City's meal limit for homeless protested. Activists say food is being held hostage by the city. Ministers, community activists, and politicians, this is a story from today, February 14th, on Saturday called for an end to the city of Gainesville's daily limit of 130 meals at the St. Francis House homeless shelter at a rally in the Bo Diddley downtown community plaza. The Reverend Milford Grinner, I'm going to try to get him on the, or maybe it's Griner, of the Rosa Parks Quiet Courage Committee said the limits must be abolished so that people who need food can get it. Meals are being held hostage by the city of Gainesville, Griner said. Let there be no more limits. Let people who need food and who are not in that magic number between 1 and 130 get food. 1 in 130. Griner added he believes the late Rosa Parks, a key figure in the civil rights movement, who refused to give up her seat on a bus for a white rider during segregation, would be calling for an end to the meal limits were she in Gainesville now. Meanwhile, the Reverend John Gillespie of St. Augustine Church and Catholic Student Center called for the community to mobilize against the limit. The St. Francis House homeless shelter and soup kitchen on South Main Street has its origins at St. Augustine. This is a liberation movement, Gillespie said. Several groups co-sponsored the event. Others provided food for distribution, while free clothes were also available. Groups have been pressing the city commission to eliminate the meal limit at the St. Francis House, saying the homeless population needs to be served. Meanwhile, our downtown merchants, however, say the meals draw the homeless while discouraging potential customers from coming. The two sides have been pitted against each other for more than a decade. Several homeless people who are getting food at the event said food and clothing are plentiful for the homeless, while shelter and services were lacking. They added, however, that the St. Francis limit should be eliminated. You never go hungry or go without clothes, said Gary Gordon, a Hawthorne man who says he currently lives on the streets in Gainesville. We need jobs. There are a lot of us living with frustration and hardship, and that's actually the claim also of a lot of Santa Cruz folk, that there are meals available, but not shelter or freedom from harassment when you try to sleep legally somewhere at night. So that is a concern apparently in both Gainesville and in Santa Cruz, although it seems there's some kind of a city law in Gainesville, apparently, although it's not really mentioned in this article, that limits the number of meals a homeless shelter could serve, which is pretty ridiculous. And I certainly would support that, lifting that limit, obviously. Let's see what else we have. I did, as I said earlier, write an article for Indy Bay, which is up on Santa Cruz Indy Media. Let's see if it's actually gone up to the top yet. Yeah, I call it Bucking Bullying Bigots and Bad Boy Blue Shirts in Downtown. And it's about the some suggestions for street performers who are approached by police to say, you're playing too loudly. You know, in a way it seems kind of secondary, the issue of street performers, because street performers are not facing arrest for sleeping. But in a way, it's sort of it's all part of the same ball of wax, because many street performers are homeless. Cal, who plays a beautiful guitar downtown, had his guitar stolen. He was telling some of us several days ago as we sat at one of the sidewalk cafes as he slept. Now, he wasn't arrested for sleeping or harassed for sleeping, but he was sleeping alone, and he was in a situation where he couldn't have been sleeping with, if he tried to sleep with a larger group of people, he would have probably quickly found that the police came to arrest, drive him away, cite him, or at very, very worst, just tell him to get moving, because of these laws that criminalize people for sleeping. Then when he comes downtown, there's the chance that someone will start complaining about his music being unreasonably loud. Well, although I've never heard that complaint made against Cal, who plays a beautiful guitar. He's like a steel guitar. By the way, if anybody's seen his guitar, please give a call to 423-HUFF. Let me know. I'll pass information on to Cal. Let's see what's coming up. Stop military recruitment in the schools, 7 p.m. February 16th. There is a Quaker meeting out at the 225 Rooney Street at the Morrissey exit of Highway 1. Stop military recruitment in our schools. Recruiting starts in movie theaters, shopping malls, and in public middle and high schools. Students as young as 11 can participate in cadet and training training corps. Military recruiters are unchecked. Aggressive advertising, extravagant gift-giving, and false promises of benefits, and harassment of preteens and teenagers. Not sure what that means. Arcata and Eureka have stopped this. The San Rafael School District has stopped this. We can, too, in Santa Cruz. Of course, Santa Cruz City Council has done nothing of the kind, as far as I know. Come here, April Burns, who has been a volunteer GI rights counselor for the past 16 years, delivered two messages, stop military recruitment in our schools, and GIs know your rights. Since 1994, the GI Rights Hotline has been providing free, confidential, and accurate information on U.S. military regulations and practices to service members, veterans, potential recruits, and their families. You can call it at 877-447-447. 4487. That's 877-447-4487. It's also, again, this notice is online. It's being sponsored by WILP, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. It's happening 7 to 8:30 on Tuesday night. And you can check that out. So, we have about 11 minutes left in the show, for those of you who are interested. I'm looking over this Santa Cruz Sentinel article on Friday, which is pretty grim. I was reading it earlier when Drum Circle Dave was on talking on the air. Santa Cruz merchants looking at ways to help polish downtown. You know, that's by polishing off the poor. I'm not particularly interested in people's civil rights right now, said Nooner, saying the Santa Cruz has become too tolerant of vagrancy. Sometimes we have to break sacred cows. On Thursday, Nooner suggested creating a rotation of business owners who will walk the avenue for an hour at a time to be an extra set of eyes and ears, similar to the Downtown Association's yellow and blue jacket hospitality staff. He said he approaches loiterers and orders them to leave, often with success. I would love to have a video camera on Nooner as he attempts to do that and let tourists see just how friendly the friendly downtown Santa Cruz is dealing with poor people in its town. Maybe they can support this by patronizing more businesses who do this, like his next space around the corner from the bookshop Santa Cruz. And we have such great homeless advocates as Councilmember Don Lame, who I earlier called Councilmember Gone Lame, who volunteers at the Homeless Services Center, said panhandling and homelessness often get tangled up in the same discussion. Well, but we know good homeless people just don't panhandle, right? Right, Don? When they are two separate problems the city is trying to address amid double-digit unemployment and slashed social services. People are absolutely right to be concerned about aggressive panhandling. It's both inappropriate on a human level and it's against the law, Lane said. Unfortunately, the term aggressive panhandling now refers to sitting quietly with a sign after dark. Thanks to the vote of Don Lane at Santa Cruz City Council on January of 2009, who also, I believe, sits on the board of directors of the Homeless Services Center. Maybe he's off it now, but he's a, you know, Mr. Homeless Concerned Compassionate Guy. And that's not very concerned. That's not very compassionate. That's packing with the bigots. And that's what Lane has done, really, for the last 20 years while masquerading as a homeless, a supportive homeless service provider. That really is my perception of him. Although he has agreed to meet with us, he's talked to us, he has raised some issues at City Council, but when the chips come down, he votes with the bigot majority. And yes, it's bigoted to criminalize people for sitting down on the sidewalk, off to the side. It's bigoted for criminalizing them for having a sign that says, need money for food after dark. It's bigoted to say you can't sit on a public bench for more than an hour to do nothing as the public benches disappear downtown into the bowels of the Parks and Rec Department because merchants don't like homeless people hanging out on the benches. That's bigoted. I'm sorry, Don. That's bigoted. If you don't know it, you better retire from public office and do something else. However, he does say, if people are poor and need some help, writing them a citation for sitting on a bench is not going to change that. But you see, Don, you facilitated the law that allowed that to happen. So what are you doing now? Are you moving to repeal that law? Not aware that you are. With police facing limited resources, the Downtown Association, a group that 550 businesses pay into, is working with the city to devise lasting solutions. But Chip, the association's executive director, who only goes by one name, said the transient population and panhandling are complex perennial problems. It's a constant issue, he said. People are very frustrated and want to know how we can deal with this right now. Just say no. What part of, no, I don't want to give you any change today, is a problem to say. Cat got your tongue? Just say, the music is too loud. Can you keep it down a little more quietly, please? And if somebody starts fighting with you about it, yeah, you can call a police officer if you have to, or a host, or a friend. Yeah, but in the meantime, you don't hide in your business and send out police officers to give out citizen arrests, or have Jeremy Nooner come running out on the street and start screaming at homeless people to move along, you loiterer. Loitering is legal in the United States, Jeremy. And we have to document what these people who are trying to make it all illegal, what they're doing, who they're doing it to, when they're doing it, and what police officers they're using to do it with. Tara Lynn, a buyer for Idle Hands, a boutique selling handmade jewelry and T-shirts on Pacific Avenue near Laurel Street, said she attended Thursday's meeting in the hopes that our involvement is bringing awareness. She and Kyoko Mundell, owner of Body Options clothing store on the north end of Pacific Avenue, said they are too fearful to confront drug dealers or aggressive panhandlers. Instead, they call police. Just don't know what to say. I want to get involved, but I'm afraid to, Mundell said. Lieutenant Rick Martinez, who supervises the police department's downtown unit, told merchants he will place additional officers downtown to push back the wave again. There are no figures in this article of citations for panhandling, of any kind of assaults, of any kind of robberies or burglaries. There's simply a whole series of assumptions and general fearful statements that are being made here. The same kind of thing that happened when these laws were passed. To me, this is, again, statisticless paranoia. These are people who are afraid of the appearance of things rather than the substance. These are people who haven't made contact with people on the streets, who are instead wanting to clear away the realities of life from before their very eyes because they don't want them in their nice little neat new neighborhood. They are relying on a fantasy, a Disneyland fantasy, as an ideal that is simply not a possibility anymore, and that if initiated would criminalize poor people anyway and deny the economic realities of the time. I'm not saying there aren't problems that problems don't occur on Pacific Avenue. They certainly do. A lot of them come from the kind of hostile police and merchant approach to poor people in public spaces that they've been using. People have become very defensive and very possessive of what little territory and rights they have left. I wish they were more so, in a way. I wish they got together and did so in a more organized and determined way. And that's, in fact, what we really need to do. I got about 5 minutes left in the show. I got to kind of download the necessary items for the upcoming afternoon. So I'm going to say goodbye and suggest that if you've had some concerns that have arisen because of the show, some questions you want to ask, some comments that you haven't had time to make or perhaps have felt too timid to make, give me a call at 423-4833 and make them to me off air. We can talk about that. You can show up at a Huff meeting if you want at 703 Pacific Sub Rosa Cafe at 10:30 on Wednesday. I'll be there. Or you can email me at rnorris3@hotmail.com. I appreciate your listening. For those of you who are listening, I appreciate even more when you call in because then I know you're listening. And thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathurst Spears Broadsides. I'll be back 6 o'clock on Thursday night. Next week I will not be here. Going to be in Detroit at the Homelessness Marathon. Thomas Levitt will be taking over my show for once in a change of roles. Thank you, Thomas. And we'll see what happens then. More information on that on Thursday. And let's hear some more from Opal Sun. If I can find her tape, that is. Here it is. And thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathurst Spears Broadsides.
This week on Making Contact.
By about 1970, the United States had sort of played itself out.
We lost 50% of our industrial workforce.
This is not a problem that's going to be solved by throwing money at banks.
It's a time of economic transition, and systems that may have seemed stable over the past few decades are proving to be far from it. But how did we get here? And how can we learn from the past to build a more fair and just system in the future? While many politicians and pundits claim that no one saw the current economic collapse coming, in fact, we had plenty of warning, depending on who we listened to. This week, we hear from three people who've been sounding the alarm about capitalism's house of cards for years, and in some cases, decades. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
In talking about the economic crisis, for me, one of the best places to start is in Cuba with Fidel. Fidel wound up writing this reflection at the end of October called Economic Illiteracy. He ends it by saying, when a people leaves behind illiteracy, and learns to read and write and possess the minimum knowledge that is indispensable for living and producing in an honorable way, they still need to overcome the worst form of ignorance in our time, economic illiteracy. Only in that way can we understand what is occurring in the world. And I just think that he hits on this point exactly right, that there are particular levels of understanding and consciousness that a lot of activists, a lot of leftists have, but don't have a deep, sophisticated understanding of the economy. And I think it inhibits us from both being able to understand what's going on around us and actually shift the course of history.
That's Steve Williams. He's the executive director and co-founder of POWER, People Organized to Win Employment Rights. He's just one of many trying to explain what's been going on in the U.S. and all over the world lately. For the first time in generations, economic theories like socialism and Marxism are being considered by the mainstream media and the public at large. So today, we're going to let three vocal critics of the failed system tell the story of why we're in the state we're in and share their ideas for moving forward. You just heard Steve Williams. We'll also hear from Rick Wolf.
We have a generation of leaders who haven't the faintest idea what to do.
He's an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
I made more money than teachers as a steelworker.
And that's Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology and urban education at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Together, they'll tell one version of the history of modern capitalism.
We now see a capitalist economic system not only facing its greatest crisis in my lifetime, and that means in most of yours, but a fast diminution of its self-confidence. We recognize not only that the system is in trouble, but we have a generation of leaders who haven't the faintest idea what to do about it. And that, too, is a fundamental shift. So I'd like to address myself, if I can, briefly, to explain how and why capitalism hit the fan. The first thing. Every president since the greatest crash so far in the 1930s, starting with Franklin Roosevelt, has made us a promise which they could not keep. The promise was not only to take steps that would bring us out of the particular downturn, but most importantly, to take steps that would prevent us from ever again having to face an economic system as unstable as capitalism has always proved itself to be. Every president promised it, and no president was able to keep the promise. We certainly have not had an end to instability.
When people talk about, popularly talk about what is the cause of the economic crisis, the thing that people will constantly refer to is greed, right? And so, well, what's interesting is that when you talk about greed, well, then the resolution to that, like the remedy is you need to stop people from being greedy. Either you transform their humanity and sort of make them selfless, you know, humanitarians, or you establish regulations to sort of limit their capacity to be able to act off of greed, right? So there's this guy, Paul Krugman, who is 2008 Nobel Prize winner, and his statement in the New York Times was, "The meltdown was caused by greed followed by fear. It was caused by a housing bubble and the greed of people who rushed in to make money off of it." But the thing that I want to sort of underscore, at least to me, what's been interesting in sort of looking at the coverage around this, is that's as deep as the analysis goes. Like, people will say, if they don't say that it's greed and fear that caused the financial crisis, it was the credit default swaps. And that's it. And so I think if we're not able to sort of look deeper at a systemic level, again, that we're just going to be sort of lost in the obscurity of the very minutiae of what it is that folks are talking about.
We are now in the second major collapse of capitalism in 75 years. And if you count, there were about a dozen smaller or not so small downturns in the interval. If you lived with a person as unstable as the economic system in which you exist, you demand they get professional help. But we as a nation seem very wary to do the same with our economic system, although I think we should.
I would say that for leftists, there are really two questions that we've got to figure out. One is, how did this crisis come into being? And then secondly, what are we going to try to do about it? I think we've got to figure this out, because the historical conjuncture that we're in is going to sort of shape the terrain that we're fighting on for the next several generations.
How is it that we got to this situation? We are not in a conventional economic downturn. I'm going to argue briefly that this is a downturn that has been building ever since at least the Civil War in the United States. At the end of the Civil War, capitalism became triumphant. It had defeated slavery, and it had subordinated self-employed businesses and small businesses to the corporate capitalism that really took off. For the next 100 years, roughly 1870 to 1970, American capitalism performed extraordinarily. Productivity went up in an almost uninterrupted process. That is, year after year, the bundles of goods and services and an hour of labor produced grew. And across the same 100 years, so did real wages. The actual bundle of goods and services workers got also rose. For 100 years, a steady rise. Extraordinary. A record not equaled by most, if any, other capitalist economies.
From about after World War II through the early 1970s, capitalism was just booming. On a global scale, capitalism wound up sort of just expanding dramatically. The rate of growth was phenomenal. And the United States wound up being sort of at the lead of it, mostly because of World War II, and colonialism had sort of inhibited anybody else from being able to develop the productive capacity that would have otherwise been possible because of the level of technological advance. So the United States was just sort of like the only show in town and was just sort of running the game.
In that period of time, because the wages kept rising, Americans began to think of their society as very exceptional. Something was special here. Wages went up, standards of living went up. It was a blessed land. And Americans came to expect their standard of living to rise, to believe they were entitled to it, to measure their own success and importance as individuals in terms of their rising standard of living. Why did the wages go up? Because the capital accumulation in our society kept running ahead of workers. For the first 50 years of that 100, we solved that problem by bringing an unprecedented number of immigrants into the country. That wasn't enough to prevent wages from rising, and they rose through that time and in the next 50 years too, until the 1970s. Stunning record.
But by about 1970, the United States had sort of played itself out. And so there were particular challenges that the United States was facing around 1970.
In the 1970s, it all came to a stop. Real wages of American workers stopped rising after a 100-year increase. The American society could not cope with this, and one of the ways it could not cope, or the form that took, was by not realizing it was going on, not making it a national conversation. What in the world is going to happen to a people who've internalized rising standards of living when their economic system doesn't provide it? Employers, starting in the 1970s, didn't have to raise wages anymore. They didn't for several quick reasons. One, a new technology, the computer, allowed people to be replaced by machines on a scale we hadn't seen before. At the same time, corporations moved jobs out of the United States to where wages and conditions were more profitable. Women began entering the labor force in record numbers, and immigrants started coming again in big numbers. You put all those things together, no more need to raise wages in the 1970s, and we have not raised real wages in any kind of sustained way ever since. To stop raising wages after 100 years in a society that has become accustomed to it is a trauma, and it's reacted to in traumatic fashion. And the way that was done produces the crisis we have now. Hence my argument that it's a deeply embedded crisis with profound roots. What happened in the last 30 years after the wages stopped going up? I'm going to answer the question by quickly looking at what the workers did and then quickly looking at what the capitalists did. What the workers did was to react to the end of rising wages, not by giving up the American dream of rising consumption, not by foregoing the measurement of one's own success in life by what one can afford. Instead, Americans did two major things. The first one was, if I can't get more wages per hour of work, I'm going to do more work. And so the husbands did more work. The old people came out of retirement. Part-timers did full-time. Teenagers went to work. But the most important thing, the women. Huge numbers of American women had to go out to work in order to keep the consumption going. And the American working class suffered in two key ways. First, it became exhausted. Today, the average number of hours worked by an American worker is 20% more than the average number of hours worked by a French, German, Italian, or Swedish worker. That's not a small difference. American workers are exhausted. And when the mothers went out to work, they couldn't sustain the pressures of the double shift that follows from this situation. And the American family began that kind of accelerated disintegration that provided one of the great opportunities for the Republican Party to return to power. And the second thing the American working class did, beside work itself to death, physically and emotionally, was to borrow more money than any working class had ever before borrowed anywhere, period. So that 30 years later, the American working class is physically exhausted, emotionally stressed, and bent out of shape with anxiety about a level of debt it knows it cannot sustain.
There are about 50 million families in the United States that carry a credit card balance of $5,000 or more. The amount of consumer credit that people wind up falling into just winds up increasing dramatically. The other thing is that then the economy of the United States really shifts much more to consumption. So 70% of the GDP of the gross domestic product of the United States is consumption of stuff. And they're buying it on credit cards.
What happened to business over the last 30 years? The biggest bonanza they had ever had. The profits went crazy for a simple reason. If each worker produces more each hour, that's what rising productivity means, but you don't have to pay him anymore, or you don't have to pay her anymore, well, then the whole benefit of rising productivity accrues to profits, which it did. And the American folks, corporate boards of directors and shareholders, who are the ones who get the profits, began to have one of the greatest picnics ever seen. So what did they do? You know what they did. They began to pay themselves stupefying salaries and bonuses. We're all angry now, but it's 30 years late. They've been doing it a long time, and no one seemed to notice or care. They went on a mergers and acquisitions binge. They invested this profit abroad.
And during this period, it was not the case alone that the problems were because of outsourcing to other countries. Yes, that was a major problem. The second problem was the rapid pace of technological change. That took place at a very rapid rate at the same time as there was tremendous financialization, you know what that is, and at the same time as there was tremendous outsourcing. But the result is that we lost 50% of our industrial workforce. And as somebody who spent his first 10 years as a worker in the steel mill, we had better jobs than most people in the service economy.
They developed into speculative manias, one after the other. The most fantastic was to go back to the working class, the fountain of all of this wealth, and say to the workers, look, now that we haven't raised your wages, after 100 years of making you expect to consume more, we have a solution. The extra profits we make by not paying you wages, we're going to turn them around and lend them to you at interest, which they did. Allowing the capitalist class to substitute for rising wages, rising loans. Now imagine yourself a businessman or woman. What would be a fantasy you might enjoy? Substituting for the rising wages your workers might otherwise demand, an alternative. Lend them the money. That way they have to pay you that back and interest. At this point, if I had a time, I'd play you the national anthem.
The other thing that wound up happening is that as particularly sort of Europe and the third world nations had developed their productive capacity, there was just more and more stuff on the global market. So then as a consequence, the capitalists who are constantly looking for new opportunities to be able to accumulate more profits, there were fewer and fewer places for people to be able to put their money and confidently be able to get profit back. Around that time is when you see the rise of neoliberalism. So you have a shift in how it is that the ruling class is managing capitalism. You move from sort of the Keynesian approach where the government is freely sort of subsidizing social contracts, safety net programs, and then you ultimately wind up moving to a situation where governments all across the globe wind up instituting neoliberal programs, cutting back on safety net programs, privatizing industries, deregulating industries, so that then essentially trying to create as free of a terrain, as free of an area for capital to be able to operate and accumulate profit as possible. So all this is playing out around the 1970s. This is also the time when you see more and more money going into speculative capital. So up until this point in time, the amount of money that was going into stocks and bonds was about one-third to one-half of the world GDP. Within about 6 years after 1970, you see the proportion shift so that now more money is going into speculation, into the stocks and bonds market, as opposed to indirect investment into production. So hopefully that then sort of sets a stage for from 1970 through about 2000.
And the problem that we are facing right now is that much of what passed for prosperity, all of the boom and bust of the last 25 years, beginning in the early 80s, when the deindustrialization began to take legs, is because much of the capital which has been generated is what Karl Marx calls fictitious capital. It's phony capital. And it disappeared just as fast it was much faster than it was produced.
This is an extraordinary history. But it produces a level of speculation and a level of overextension of the financial sector that's the perfect parallel to the other kind of overextension of the working class that financed it, that made it possible, and that is even more exhausted than the capitalists now are. These are not short-term problems. No quick fix here. This is not going to be solved by conventional Keynesian monetary and fiscal policy or by getting the credit systems going again. Who's going to borrow? The exhausted workers who can't sustain their current debts? The companies who can't keep producing since the workers can't buy it anyway? This is a fundamental problem, which is why this is not your usual economic downturn.
In my opinion, the ruling class is trying to run the most elaborate sleight of hand that we've ever seen.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to our program featuring Steve Williams, Rick Wolf, and Stanley Aronowitz.
So then, what is to be done? I don't think the conventional approaches will work. I propose an alternative. I think our problem is that we have not yet been willing as a nation to face the reality that the corporate structure, which dominates and has dominated since the Civil War, is a structure that does not work. The mass of people go to work each day. At the end of the day, they go home. They leave behind what they poured their creativity into. Who decides what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits is a completely other group of people, a tiny minority, a board of directors, which in most corporations runs 15 to 20 people, who are responsible to the company's major shareholders, which is another group of 50 to 20. The tiniest of minorities governs the economic system, and they make bad decisions. over and over again. And all we seem to come up with as a nation are a lot of policies that we hope maybe, if we're lucky and if they're nice, will make them behave better. And we're outraged that they don't. And our capacity for repeated outrage is stunning. Let's change the organization of that institution which produces the goods and services we all depend on. We don't need it anymore, and we can't tolerate it anymore, and we ought to have the courage to get rid of it. Just like once upon a time we decided politically that our leaders have to be responsible to us, the same really ought to apply to economics, don't you think? The businesses of America ought to be operated and run by the workers who work in them. That change goes to the heart of the current crisis. If workers had run the businesses the 1970s, the rising real wage would not have come to a stop. If I had time, and I don't want to take more time, I could talk to you about all the different ways workers can operate their own businesses. I would talk to you about how that's democracy at the workplace. I would tell you that if workers were able to run their own businesses, the difference between mental and manual labor would be overcome, a dream of all socialists for hundreds of years, that workers would be asked to run their own affairs. And you know, if they ran them in the workplace, they damn well demand to run them everywhere else, too. The formality of our democracy might become real politically if it were real economically. Is it a bold proposal? You bet. The old approaches have not worked. It's time for something new, and this crisis calls for nothing less than the kind of leadership that socialists who can dare think like this can provide by pursuing these ideas and seeing to it that the rage that is building on our society doesn't become an opportunity for the next George Bush to ride in.
There are a couple things that we've got to be paying attention to. One is the rise of the right. The degree to which the neoliberal right is discredited is real. But the other thing is that the reactionary right is also on the rise. So the Southern Poverty Law Center just put out a report saying that there are, I think it was 38% more hate groups in the United States now than there were last year that they're tracking. Use the example of one particular website and said that the day after Obama got elected, the membership on this white supremacist website went up 2,000 members overnight. The degree to which you can already see the sort of nativist, like, blame everybody outside the United States, particularly immigrants, that's going to continue to rise. I think that it's important for us to be mindful of that and figure out how it is that we can play sort of a defensive role for this regime and what it is that they're trying to do. But I think that it's also important for us to be clear that we're not the liberals, that we are the left, and the left should be acting like the left.
When we think about what it was that really created the jobs that were produced by the New Deal in the Works Projects Administration and the various programs, it was not Franklin Roosevelt being a wonderful guy. We had a movement called End Poverty in California at the same time as you had two general strikes, one in San Francisco, the other in Minneapolis, a big movement in Toledo, garment workers and miners on strike, and Roosevelt said, Jesus, God, I better get my shit together, because if I don't get my shit together, I'm going to sink. And it was true, he could have sunk. And what he knew that we've forgotten, I have to say this, is that in that period when we had the beginning of jobs programs and the government actually directly employed people, did not give it to subcontractors, did not give it to banks or anybody else, is that we had a communist party, we had a socialist party, we had Trotskyists, we had anarchists, and they were all fighting and organizing.
With that, I think that there are things that we should be doing. The first is to promote socialism. And I think the scale of this crisis and the popular outrage that exists around it just creates historic opportunities and openings that could actually spark the renewal of a radical movement in this country. But it's going to take us being clear and talking about the fundamental flaws of capitalism and that we can actually build an alternative. And obviously, around the globe, there are a lot of people doing that. So I point specifically to Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian movement in Venezuela, where they're talking explicitly about socialism of the 21st century and are trying to sort of invent sort of a new project.
But socialism for the 21st century has to have new dramatic visions that will galvanize people with the thought of something new and different that can make a real difference.
I think once we have this sort of clear long-term vision, it then gives us the possibility of figuring out, well, how is it that we're trying to make policy interventions on what's going on in a day-to-day basis? So I think it's important for us to be clear that being a leftist isn't just sort of reading theory books and passing out newspapers at rallies that we didn't organize. But instead, what it means is having this vision and beginning to make sort of policy suggestions that could actually sort of begin the long road from capitalism to socialism.
This is not a problem that's going to be solved by throwing money at banks. This is a problem of a fundamental overextension of a working class that has to be addressed in the most fundamental way by how we organize our life, organize our family unit, and organize the work process.
Just sort of like trying to prep for this, I wound up coming across this quotation from Marx that I just thought was interesting and wanted to end with. The centralization of the means of production and the socialization of labor reach a point at which they become incompatible with their capitalist enclosure. This casting is burst asunder, the knell of capitalist private property sounds, and the expropriators are expropriated. So I think that there's some real opportunities for us, so we should get to it.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Today's program featured the voices of Steve Williams, the executive director and co-founder of POWER, People Organized to Win Employment Rights, Professor Rick Wolf, whose most recent books include New Departures in Marxian Theory and Class Theory and History, and Professor Stanley Aronowitz, author of Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Aronowitz's speech was from a March 2009 forum presented by WBAI Radio and the New York Society for Ethical Culture, and is courtesy of Building Bridges. Steve Williams spoke in February 2009 at the Bay Area Progressive Club, and Rick Wolf spoke at the Left Forum in April 2009. Special thanks to our intern, Megan Martigny, for helping to produce this show. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.